The crime is heard out of Zion, for we are greatly confused. For death has come into our ghettos to cut off the young men and women from the streets of Philadelphia, New York, L.A., Georgia, Ohio, Florida, Mississippi, and throughout America, South America, the Caribbean islands, Africa, Asia, and all over the world. So return unto me, thus saith Yah, and I will return unto you, O my people.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom with all thy getting. Get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and listen to the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening, and listen to the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening, which is in the Black Belt, and listen to the live stream there also. And to any of your handheld devices, you can download TuneIn. And it's a free app. And then in TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon, and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, you can type in Time for an Awakening. You'll always see interesting content being posted daily. And before you leave that page, do me a favor and hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook. And Time for Awakening Media is there also, full of new content, podcasts of the different programs, and always provocative articles being posted on Time for an Awakening. So check it out. Make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, we're scheduled to have a special guest join us. He's been here several times before. He's joining us again, talking about a project that they're launching down at Morgan State University. Author, lecturer, and professor of media and Africana studies at Morgan State University, Dr. Jared Ball, is scheduled to be with us this evening. And we'll be right back to kind of get the program started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. for podcasting or live program scheduling. Hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and R Street. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, brother.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. Yeah, you know, the day was a little busy because of the activity down in Philadelphia today. Every year they have the Black History Showcase, and so the museum, as a volunteer at the museum, kind of went and, you know, helped out and been a part of the host of different organizations that provide cultural and historical information to Philadelphia at this time. So it was exciting, but I'm really excited to engage with Brother Jared Ball this evening. There's so much to talk about and so much to continue to learn, and putting history in analysis, especially media analysis, is something that we have to continue to develop.
Yeah, because I know that you ran into him when he was here, I guess about a month and a half ago at the function that you saw him at.
And, yeah, the Black History Collaborative.
Yeah, and he was discussing. Go ahead.
Yeah, Professor Ball is really, I think, the kindredness is that the realizing race and class is a predominant, we should continue to make that a predominant understanding with our analysis in every area of human activity and study. And I think he really, in dealing with what he presented, was cogent and to those teachers and educators there, was cogent in relationship to the workshop topic. So plus I learned about his race and media research project that he's developing, which he's asking for our support as a community, which I think is important for our audience to know, to provide.
And that's one of the things that we're going to be discussing tonight. And we'll spin off and talk about a few other topics with our special guest with us this evening, lecturer and professor of media and African studies at Morgan State University, Dr. Jared Ball is with us. And before I bring Dr. Ball on, I just again want to welcome in our listeners over there from the UK that's listening on fundsahara.uk. That's our version of, Night Talk.
To say for those who want to stay up and catch it, you know.
Yeah, because it's 1 o'clock there, but any of the listeners that's listening over there can still join in with the conversation. They have to dial a special number and then dial our 215 number. They have to dial 02-3514-1993 and press pound, and then type in the regular dial-in number of the 215-490-9832 if they choose to join into the conversation. But again, I just want to welcome in our listeners at fundsahara.uk. And in fact, in other countries in Africa, they're hearing it too. So Again, I want to welcome in our listeners that are listening on that venue. And let's welcome in our special guest, Dr. Ball. Dr. Ball, how are you, sir?
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for having me again.
I'm always happy to have you join us, man, in conversation.
Yes, sir, Dr. Ball.
You know, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, I was just speaking to the both of you. Thank you again. Okay. I appreciate it.
You know, Dr. Ball, Brother Richard told me that he saw you about a month and a half ago here in Philadelphia. And you, then you presented the ideal of the Race and Media Research Center that's going to be operating out of Morgan State University. Before we get into the nuts and bolts of it, talk about what made you come up with this idea, whether it was yours or you know, whether it was a collaborative effort. Talk about the genesis of it before we kind of talk about what it is.
Oh man, to be frank, I want to be honest with you and your audience, and the real answer to that question probably we can't get into publicly.
I understand. I understand. But just tell me a little bit. Just tell me a little.
Well,
something.
I mean, because part of it is just the length of time, and the other part of it is just building the context, and then some of it is just that it's probably just not appropriate.
I know
for public conversation. But I'll say it this way. I mean, the idea came out of like many great ideas, like many things that we end up having to do out of struggle. And one thing that I think a lot of people who are understandably who are not in academia don't always realize is that a lot of what goes on there is a struggle. Now, part of it, I think, is how it's supposed to be honest, in the sense that I think the ideal, and I still have some naivete around this, that the ideal is that you're going to have a bunch of people who are committed to intellectual engagement study and perspectives and interdisciplinary work, who would be willing to debate and disagree, and that's all well and good. And I think debate and disagreement is fine. But the reality is that there are a lot of power struggles, there's a lot of ego, there's a lot of business, a lot of politics. And so a lot of what is thought to be happening at universities is, I think, misunderstood. And then a lot of what people see projected from universities who are not themselves engaged with universities is as much a construct as everything else we see promoted to the world. So, but the long story short, I made this short, is there was just some struggle and some conflict and I think a righteous attempt to carve out some space. I proposed as a solution to several problems that the university, basically let me try to put my money where my mouth is and say, we can let there be some cutting edge work created. There's obviously a need. Despite all the discussion of media and all the discussion of popular culture, there's a lot of need for some sustained study. And as we see happening in the lived experiences of our people and many others in this country and around the world, there's a lot of real consequence for our lack of understanding of our media environment and how it interacts with us and so on. So the basic project is, I have until the end of this year, more or less, to demonstrate to the university that I can develop this center and that there's support for it, and that ultimately, as is the case with everything, that there's funding that I can find for it. And that's always, the where much of the conflicts arise. But so far, there's been a lot of support. There's been some support from, folks within the university, obviously with the Institute for Urban Research and Dr. Ray Wimbush, mm-hmm. And some others. And then, we'll see. So that's basically it. And part of the pitch I'll be making, as I've already started to make, is that as we've seen with the 50th anniversary of the Kerner Commission report from 1968, so much of what that report said 50 years ago has played out. And we saw it occur, you know, live and direct in 2015 in Baltimore with the post-Freddie Gray uprising. And we can see the consequences of that report playing out all around the country. And one of the lesser known points of the report was that they said we need an urban research communications center that will you know, better organize and professionalize the intersecting relationship of race and media. And, you know, we don't really have such a center, at least not at the university, not really situated in that way. There's obviously a lot of what the Kerner Commission report said playing out in terms of media representation, police interaction with the press, police interaction obviously with the community, and how all of that is carried out and reported on, and the impacting of reporting and what's not reported on in the city, and so on and so forth. And then when we see what was happening with the uprising in 2015, the exact same things that the Kerner Commission report said as a result of its research into what the press did in covering the 1967 summer uprisings in Detroit and Newark, we saw the exact same thing happen in Baltimore. So in terms of what the press did and didn't do and how people reacted and interacted and what was some of the impact of that. So all that to say, yeah, this is the attempt, and we'll see. And hopefully when I come back on with you all in the fall, I'll have some good news to report.
Dr. Ball, because I do want to spin off on a conversation on some of those findings in that Kerner Commission as it's relevant today. But let me say this, because I respect that you can't speak on a lot of these things, and I don't blame you. But let me say it in this respect. Me and Richard talk about on this program, and I quote a Bible verse in the beginning, that our people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. That's one of our main stumbling blocks here for blacks that dwell here in the United States, and worldwide for that matter, that we don't have the information on what's going on. And a lot of the information that we do have is from a Eurocentric slant, or is filtered. I think it's necessary that we start establishing independent venues. You know, we had some in the past that kind of stood out, at least for me. Folks from the Philadelphia area will remember Reggie Bryant and his show, Brother Richard, the Black Perspective on the News.
Yeah.
Tony Brown had the Tony Brown's Journal for years. Gil Noble
had. Apparently that's coming back. Sorry to interrupt, but I heard that's coming back.
With Tony Brown?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. He's in his 80s, 84, I think, or maybe a little older.
Hey, that's what I thought, too. But,
goes to show what we're talking about here. Gil Noble with the show Like It Is. Up there in New York, it's a need for these type of dialogues and programs to kind of give our people a flavor of what's really going on. I don't think a lot of our people, and sometimes it's not their fault because they have misleadership that is out here that don't inform the people that our people are at war. It's this government has been at war with black men, black people since we've been here, and we don't realize that. And there's some people on the academic side that don't realize it either. They think that we're just living here in a struggle for equality and, you know, just putting it in layman's terms. But it's a lot deeper than that. And the more we start establishing venues and organizations that's bringing issues to the public, to our public, that's African-centered, where we can discuss these issues from our perspectives and see what we need to do as a people, then we're going to be like on this treadmill with our legs moving fast and not going anywhere. So I respect what you're doing. Time for Awakening started out on an independent terrestrial radio station here in Philadelphia, and we were there for 5 years. But when the owner died and the different management took over and had a different, and I respect, whatever they chose to do, but when they had a different outlook on the direction of the station, we didn't stop. We just moved to another venue, and we've still been doing the program because it's a need for information. It's a need for people to hear yourself and others that come on this program, because if they tune in just to normal, and that's not that many black talk stations on a terrestrial level, but if they tune in just to normal stations, they're not going to hear voices like yourself, Dr. Ray Winbush, other people that we have on this program. They're not going to hear them. They'll hear a daily dose of laughing and joking with the Steve Harveys and the Joiners and the others with all types of satires and giggling 6 days a week. I totally respect what you're doing. Oh, Brother Richard, jump in here before I mention something.
No, I was looking for in what you didn't say, raising, and hopefully you can help me out on this and help us out on this. When the boys wanted to do the Atlanta study, and it was supposed to be a series of studies in Atlanta to kind of lay out the economic, to define the black economy in Atlanta or in the South. And he wanted to do from Atlanta University. Am I correct to say, that it was internal struggle in order to get that proposal put to the table so it can actually be implemented? Are you aware of that in the sense of that thought being correct or that information being correct?
Oh, if you're asking me, I don't know anything about that. I couldn't speak on that situation. I don't know. Off the top of my head, I honestly don't know anything about the context in which that report was developed at Atlanta University. But Du Bois and many others, I mean, just in their careers and themselves, if we look carefully, even down the road here at Howard University, a lot of illustrious names have had difficult relationships with these institutions over time. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we were looking at early this year, Morgan State University, the same president disinvited and then reinvited Du Bois at two different times over a 20-some year period based on Du Bois' politics and popularity at the time. Mm. There's always going to be some sort of politicized context in what all faculty do. And if you have prominent faculty that are doing or looking to upset pockets mm-hmm. of power and funding, then there may or may not be different forms of struggle around that. So, but with that particular case, I really don't know.
And the only reason I'm trying to bring that up in the sense of, as you say, that kind of institutional struggle, especially in black universities, because I heard you kind of lay out, the need for the race and media research because of, say, the Kerner Commission. So I'm just trying to get a handle on, from our vantage point as far as listeners and the community in general, why it becomes also important that we are aware of, of these kind of institutional initiatives that really would be better for us in making personal decisions in the locale we are in. And I want to emphasize when you say support that people, we should realize that we should be giving you support, and which raises the question, how could the community give support to your initiative in relationship, since you have a time frame about it?
That's a good question. I off the top of my head, I'm not even sure how that would work. I mean, there's a couple things here that I think on the one hand, just in terms of there could be, for instance, calls for, signing on to public statements or just spreading the word or attending conferences that are set up regionally or supporting work that is eventually produced, or offering up challenges and critiques. to work that is produced. That would be the way I would think, you know, because ultimately the one goal, at least, of the center would be to provide a service to various specific elements within a variety of communities, but in particular those, for instance, who are in the community who are doing activist work or community journalism work or anything that might benefit from, you know, organized professional studies on a given subject. So it could be a variety of ways. But the other thing that we also have to be honest about and be careful about is that there's a certain limit on the sovereignty of even efforts like this happening at a Morgan State, even within the Institute for Urban Research. And a lot of that has to do with funding. So a lot of the funding is likely going to be attached to efforts or institutions that are certainly not African-centered, and in some cases maybe flat-out reactionary. And in this way, as a cautionary tale, or as an example, we can see how efforts like this are limited and how situations, even the most positive or the most potentially advanced, are limited by the context that we find ourselves in. And again, largely attached to funding. And this is the case, whether it's a research center, a university, or a media project or a journalism project. So much of the control and the management is carried out simply through funding or advertising. And I would be lying to you and to whoever else if I said that this effort wouldn't be, or that this effort would be in many ways any different. The unfortunate reality is there are no deep pockets of independent, sovereign, African-centered, or I would even argue just generally radical or progressive pockets of money that can sustain the kind of funding that you would need to put centers like this together.
Dr. Ball, let me ask you a question, because we can see through history that, and this is just my opinion, and usually if we had think tanks to talk about a lot of these things, and I'm talking about more think tanks because there is some out there, these things could be debated. But I think that personally, if you look at our history, we've made mistakes by depending on what you were just talking about, money from other sources. Mm-hmm. I think that now we can, and that would be a challenge. Our challenge is to develop money streams from other sources, either developing conscious people here with money, talking to people on the continent with money. And I'll just use an example. Danny Glover, he wanted to do a movie in reference to the independent struggle that happened in Haiti. Mm-hmm. And he got the door slammed in his face from producers here in the United States and in England. So he went to, because he had developed a friendship in the past with the leader of Venezuela, and his name just blew up right out of my head.
Hugo Chavez.
Yes, mm-hmm. And the movie was supposed to be done down there. They already had the stars chosen. They were getting ready to start shooting when he died. And I think that movie project must have died. But I'm just using that as an example of going outside the box to develop money streams for what we need to do. I remember when we had Milton Alamadi on Time for Awakening, which has the Black Star News online on the internet. And he was on our program and talked about how he needed some funds to help get his project started. And he wrote letters to several of the prominent people that we know of, the Jordans, the Oprahs. And the one person that gave him money with no strings attached, and it didn't necessarily surprise me, but I was surprised, was Bill Cosby. He said Bill Cosby helped him start that Black Star News Online, which is an independent black news online newspaper, so to speak. So I think that might be our challenge. And, you know, the folks that's working along with you, whether me and Brother Richard is fortunate enough to do it or whatever, I think that's going to be the challenge, is to try to develop sources of money streams other than these normal faces that we see, because it ends up happening, it always ends up happening to be white and sometimes Jewish conglomerates or organizations or folks that end up steering things in the direction they want to, and they you know, they handle the money, so, or they provide the money, so I guess they figure they have the right to do it. But we need to, I think, and, you know, you can weigh in, Brother Richard, I think that we need to develop other sources where we can deal with this other than some of the traditional sources that we've been going to.
The thing that I'm looking at based off of what all of us are saying is that, especially from our vantage point, we, you know, because I hear, Brother Ball, you know, that it may be some constraints, and rightfully so, because I think institutions and have to go and get what they need from other places. But we in the community, when I raise the question of what can the community, we can be able to do that kind of lobbying or identify people who have that kind of stream, because I think it becomes our responsibility in the community in general to say, these are the kind of things we need. So when you say a research and media research center, that information, especially for now, the internet as it becomes the information outlet compared to terrestrial radio or television, and you see these blogs and are you know, of different types are raising all over, we have to be able to assist in making them strong from that independent perspective because of the history that we see has occurred in the past. So that's what I would think that we're kind of saying too, or at least I'm pulling out to kind of raise, you know, that, because I would like to see Brother Ball, your analysis. I really like that piece that you're doing on your thing. It was at the something with the car that you had,
academics and cars. Yeah.
I mean, I'm really, you know, I mean, that is a novel kind of creation. You know, where here institutional individuals who are bringing information, but doing it in a different kind of format than we're used to. It's not the format, it's the information. And you're, you know, having the guests, and y'all are just having these here casual back and forth from your prospective studies is important. And I want to bring up, which I heard Derek Muhammad, who did his, you know, racial wealth analysis. And I think that ties to the Kerner Commission that you were speaking to earlier. So things like that, that's what I'm trying to say, is the community's responsibility.
So that's Diedrich Muhammad, who was in that most recent one. I appreciate that. And I would encourage people to check out amixwhatilike.org and they can see, you know, all those episodes. And it is a fun project, just the twist on what I see other people doing and just trying to get some other kinds of conversation and new ways to have conversations. But that's very different than what. So on the one hand, I want to say I am all for efforts at grassroots community, collective economic, wealth building, sharing, redistribution, et cetera. But the reality is that's not realistic in terms of building and developing and institutionalizing an academic research center at a university. So on the one hand, I wouldn't even want a community effort to try to develop what little funds exist in the community to be used for something to be housed at a university. That's unnecessary, especially since the university exists and has and exists to collect more resources from the state and private foundations, et cetera, and so forth. So I wouldn't want that to be the case. But also, we are talking apples and oranges. So when we're talking about me doing academics and cars, we're talking about me throwing a camera on the dashboard of my car and giving friends of mine a ride and editing that on my own and posting that on my own and you know, largely being a one-person operation. That's very different than trying to develop and institutionalize a research center where you are looking to hire researchers and postdoctoral fellows and media producers and so on and so forth, where you really ultimately need millions of dollars. And you know, there's just no way, particularly an African or a Black community here in the United States that has no money, is going to compete with, you know, all of these Mellon and Able and other foundations out here who have those endowed resources and exist to fund these kinds of projects. So the when you're talking about, you know, these individual examples, I mean, this is a part of the problem. One, I agree. Black people here need to be better organized and to realize that we do need to make progressive relationships with people outside of this country and in other communities, even within this country. That's great, and I largely agree with that. But it also speaks to the powerlessness and the lack of economic resources that we have that you would need to have a Danny Glover, who is a movie star for decades, having to go outside of the country and still to this day not be able to have made that movie.
Yeah.
Or that you would need to have a Milton Alamadi who's been producing research that I've been studying, seminal research, going back 20-some years now. It's absurd that he would have to go sending individual letters to individual, you know, rich Black people to get a website funded. But so part of it is a lack of organization and an absence of consciousness. But the bigger problem, or not the bigger problem, the additional problem is that there are no material resources in Black America to fund all of these things and to fund them at the levels that they need to be funded to sustain collective well-being. So this is why there are so many different things that I think need to occur. But in terms of attempts to collectivize our resources, I would not recommend that they be done for something like a project I'm working on.
Okay.
So, you know, the support I'm looking for at this point would just be just sort of a general community awareness. And as I was saying earlier, just to say, I'll speak positively that when we get this thing off the ground, that you be seen as stakeholders. In other words, like I said, so for instance, just as an example, I would love it, even though we're housed in Baltimore, I would love it if we were at the position where you all could reach out to my center and say, we need an updated analysis of Philadelphia's media environment. That is, how do people in Philadelphia use media? How do Black Philadelphia residents use media?
Okay.
What media targets them? What does their media environment look like? From everything from billboards to artwork on the walls in the communities. I mean, to digital technology, to advertising, to news media, et cetera. And then you say, like, we need this updated. We need this research done. We need to commission a report from your center. And then we would produce it for you. And we would produce multimedia and written work and whatever that you could then use. Then the way you would support it would be, A, by requesting the work, and then B, promoting it and saying, we think they did a good job, and this is what a research center and this is what an actual university community relationship might look like, when we get past some of the Ivy Tower mythology and confusion and all the other distances and all the other whatever. But this is just one way that the center could partner with a number of different groups. That's the kind of way I'm saying that, you know, at this point that I would be looking for support from you all and whoever out in the community. But in terms of resources, no, I wouldn't ever ask the community to invest in resources that are going to be used for a university endeavor, especially when the university itself and its connections, by definition, should be raising those resources. So,
okay.
I hope that makes sense, man.
Oh yeah, yeah. And, you know, and I appreciate the honesty that you raised, and you did it also with the whole thing of how much the thing about dollars. You know, I forgot the research you did as far as our spending power. You know, using
the buying power.
Yeah. I mean, being clear of what the Black community really have and supporting. And I think that it makes us be honest about where we are within the American structure as far as our economic standing and what we can and cannot do or what we should be organizing towards. So I personally appreciate that you're honest, because a lot of people, you know, give us a more romantic or, you know, kind of emotional, you know, positive spin when there's some structural realities that we should be, and the audience and us should be really clear on.
We're in conversation with professor and media and Africana studies at Morgan State University. Dr. Jared Ball is with us in conversation. You can be involved too by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Dr. Ball, the Kerner Commission report 50 years later, you know, that statement that is always, the famous statement that was made, our nation is moving towards two societies, one Black, one white, separate and unequal, you know, it's false on its premise. But this country was established as two societies, one Black, one white, separate and unequal. So it wasn't moving towards it in the 60s. It was there from the inception. But let me read two paragraphs here, because I want you to kind of break off into this conversation. And it dealt with some of the conclusions from that report. It said, in responding to why the rebellions occurred, the Kerner Report pointed to African Americans' frustration and feelings of powerlessness regarding extremely high rates of unemployment and underemployment, poverty, police brutality, and inadequate public services. The report continued that a largely poor Black population was confined to central cities, while a predominantly white population moved out, and that racism of white Americans was essentially responsible for the explosive mixture leading towards uprisings. Answering what can be done to prevent this in the future, the commission suggested that federal government intervene to improve housing, education, employment opportunities, and social services for African Americans. Also, to dismantle discriminatory practices in education, employment, the police force, and criminal court systems. President Johnson accepted the report but did not support the conclusions, and minimal effort was made to address the problems identified by the commission. Talk about those conclusions from your perspective, because I know you did Go ahead.
I'm sorry to cut you off. Yeah, I did, and I would invite No, I'm sorry. I got a little anxious to cut you off.
No, go ahead.
What were you quoting there? What were you quoting there?
I was reading from this summary. It was an online publication dealing with the summary here of this report.
Okay, because the only reason I asked is because I think it's the wording was interesting, because Johnson called for the report in 67 after the uprisings in Newark and Detroit, and he wanted a report that basically that, you know, really what he was trying to do was put a salve on the wound, and he was trying to say, look, we need to be seen to be doing something, so I need a report that's going to answer the question, why are these Black people rioting, and how are we going to make it stop going forward? But when the report came out, and I wouldn't be the first or only one to point this out, which the report may be the most honest federal government report ever, And that's a relative statement, but okay, it may be true. When the report came out, Johnson did not welcome it. He didn't even let it be delivered to the White House because it did exactly what he did not want it to do. What he wanted was a report. He even threatened the people he put on the commission with cutting off their genitalia if they didn't if they didn't come up with the conclusions that he had preordained. But he wanted the report to say, and I did. I wrote a pretty big, for me at least, for relatively speaking, for the website at least, a long piece on it that people can get at imixwhatilike.org, race rebellion and reporting and research, Baltimore and the Kerner Commission at 50. And what I was looking at it was because Johnson wanted the report to say by the way, it's the same thing. I mean, if people paid attention to what happened in Baltimore, everywhere else in this country, even right now with this so-called black identity extremist nonsense, what he wanted the report to say was these lunatic fringe radicals and outside agitators caused all the problems. Most black people are not really that angry. This is just, a couple of accidental things and it'll be taken care of, but a couple of, Johnson Great Society poverty programs and, some welfare and all of that, and everything will get back to normal. We'll be good. But the report came out and said the exact opposite. It said, Johnson, everything you want to do, every prescription you have with your Great Society stuff is insufficient. And what I'm arguing is that what they were really saying, and this is why the Kerner Commission report, one reason why we are intentionally limited to that statement that you quoted from the beginning, not only was it incendiary, but I think it was intentionally created for us, or intended subsequently for us to only focus on that, and then to only focus on the media aspects of it, which is this one chapter of the 300-page plus page report, is that what the report is actually saying is that every Democratic Party liberal program that just appeases poor people enough to stop more rebellion is really insufficient in the long run, because all they do is recreate poverty. They give false hope. They give fake prescriptions that aren't going to have anything to do with real structural inequality, economic inequality, capitalism. They didn't use that word, but and then fundamentally, the white supremacy, of course, they didn't use that phrase either, that's so inherent at this point to the national will, that the report was saying there has to be a national will that there's going to be a change in any of this. In other words, the country really has to get to the point almost philosophically where it says we don't want to be a racist, white supremacist, capitalist, oppressive, exploitative nation anymore. We want to live somewhere else. So the report was saying, if we don't have any of that, all your little programs are going to fail. We're going to see more uprisings in the future. And black people who are angry at the system and the police force that protects the system are right. I mean, the report was saying, like, so the report, Johnson would have wanted the report to say, oh, man, these Malcolm X wannabes, created all of this and we're going to get rid of them and that's going to be that. But the reality is the report was saying the country itself is the problem. So Johnson tried to kill the report. Johnson didn't try to keep it from being published. The only reason the first newspaper reports came out about the report was because people on the commission leaked it because they knew that the president was trying to kill it. And as I said, he didn't even let it be delivered to the White House. And to this day, none of what the commission said should happen has ever happened. So that's why we saw 2015 and we saw Ferguson, and we're going to continue to see more.
You know, go ahead, Richard. Go ahead.
The thing that comes to my mind, and as we look at that 50 years and you're looking at it from the vantage point of media, do you think that the media projection using this 50-year mark that everybody does, whether it be black media or white media, has really brought out that point that you brought out in the, because I think I'm starting to see a lot of articles around the economic. I just seen what the Brookings just did something on the structural economics, and somebody else did a full Black boys, family structure still matters. Are we being honest?
That New York Times, no. See, that's the thing. So that's the key. So to put it in the context of Koerner, I think what we're seeing here are more misrepresentations of what's really happening, because the press in general does not do an adequate job of telling the truth on a daily basis of what it means to be Black or what it means to be working class or poor in this country. So when you see these reports, there's been a huge amount of critique, and rightfully so, of the New York Times piece about Black boys and its juxtaposition against girls. And I can't actually recall all the details of it right here, but my point is it was insufficient. And a lot of the stuff that I end up reviewing when it comes out around buying power or Black economics or the racial wealth divide is insufficient, because it does what the Koerner report warned against. It couches it in either insufficient or poor data, or more importantly, it puts it in the context where nothing can be understood, because so little is done on a routine basis to let white people know what it really means to be white in this country and what it really means for Black people to be Black. So when these issues get brought to the main stage, so to speak, there's no context, and there's just a bunch of confusion and misinterpreted data or just flawed data, you know, in methodology to begin with. So what we end up seeing, what the state's response was to the Koerner Commission was, fine, you're saying in the Koerner Commission report that we need more Black journalists and more Black people on TV. Fine, we'll give you more Black people on TV, and they'll give us just what we get. We get the Don Lemons, and we get the as you were saying earlier, we get the Tyler Perrys, we get the Steve Harveys. They're fine. Like, fine, you get Oprah. You get we'll give you Black people on TV. And this is why, again, Kwame Ture, and I keep quoting this and we'll never stop, was so right when he said Black visibility is not Black power. So they were like, fine, you want Black power and you want more Black people on TV. Well, we'll give you at least half of that. And then we'll give you, then this year, like the epitome of it. Just last month, Disney gives us the Black Panther movie and people really are, I think, more than ever. Even though I've been impressed with, I got to contradict myself here, I've been wildly impressed with some of the critique of the film, but in general, I we have seen an enormous propaganda success of, you know, re-symbolizing, you know, Black freedom and liberation struggles and Pan-Africanism. And turning all of that into a Disney cartoon or Disney, you know, worldview comic or film, but the media or the journalism or the analysis that we would need to truly understand what's happening and to truly deal with it, we don't get any of that. So then you'll see. So it's almost actually. Let me just quickly summarize it this way. Your point is perfect. You get that New York Times piece dropped in after the Black Panther movie comes out, and it's right. Like it's like a drop of semi-relevant, although wildly flawed, data in this ocean of propaganda and mythology, and making almost none of it interpretable.
I think correct me if I'm wrong, the think tanks are involved, because the Brookings report dealing with the same topic seems to, you know, kind of in some way say the same thing. But as you say, with the Koerner Commission report, it was saying these are structural things that you really can't talk about catching up with wealth. The way things are arranged at this point, you know, so any notion of how long it'll take before Black people be able to equal white people with wealth is really, it seems just something to say, but it becomes the think tank providing some information, like it's something to move towards, like the Panther movie, to move towards this here
point where you're technologically and culturally isolated, because ain't that what you want? But not how can it happen under a more global kind of structure of the way white supremacy has moved to in financing financial system compared to just the capitalists of maintenance of the structure. So that's the reason why I think your point is of research is so important.
But in the context of Kerner, where Kerner is saying, you can't just do another poverty program. You can't just do another jobs training program. You can't just do another after school program. This is ultimately what Brookings and all these other reports end up saying tacitly or explicitly. Or worse, you get the Urban League reports and you get Mark Morial and you get Roland Martin coming on TV and doing big events around the state of black economics. Mm-hmm. But their solution is just exactly what Kerner is saying won't work. Their solution is saying, you know, black people should invest in blackness, and black people should save their money, and black people should spend more wisely, and black people should invest in an education and get job training. And what the Kerner Commission is saying is that, you know, in so many words, and then I'll elaborate in my own way here, is that stuff doesn't work in part because of the structure that requires the inequality that we suffer. You know, poverty is not the result of a lack of financial literacy. It's not that poor people are just stupid and don't know how to get rich. That's not why we're poor. That's not why any group is poor. So when you just what the Kerner Commission was saying is, if all you're going to end up doing is telling black people to save their money and go to a jobs training program and try to go to college, well, we're going to have another rebellion in another few years, because in fact, the Kerner Commission even said anger is going to increase when people realize that these false hopes don't work. And look at what. And so, I mean, we have to realize, we have to be aware, at least, of how this so-called Black Lives Matter moment happened during the Obama administration.
Right.
This is the point. People are, it's like the moment you're saying, wait a minute, there's beautiful black families in the White House and we're still being dragged and you know, murdered by the police in the street. Well, wait a minute. We have to have a whole uprising now while we have a black president. That's sort of that's what Kerner was saying 50 years ago. The commission was saying, this all white, one black person on the commission, all white, all male. I think there might have been, actually, I think there was one woman on it. But they all said, look, if you really don't want any more riots, then you better really get over your racism and really get over your capitalism. Now, they didn't use those words, but that's really what they were saying.
That's what it comes down to.
Right. And this country has not made any step forward in getting over its racism or its capitalism. So we might as well buckle up, because there's about to be some more uprisings in the next, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes. I don't know.
Yeah, you definitely see the manifestation of it. And I mean, even with this brother that just got killed in Sacramento and the response from his brother, you know, it's a different kind of response in relationship to how these things are happening in this particular generation compared to the generation of Kerner, where it was before the organizing was occurring, before the rebellion. And now it's the organizing hasn't occurred, in my mind, while the rebellion, and the rebellion is taking a different mix when you talk about Baltimore or Florida or, you know, California, different places in California.
Let's go to Newport News. Newport News.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Yes, sir. How are you?
I'd like to say hello to Dr. Bell. I used to stalk him on Facebook and send emails all the time. My name is Griffin, out of Newport News, Virginia. I applaud your work. I want to ask you on this thing, Black Panther thing. My biggest problem is engaging with you.
Wait a minute. Your voice went in and out. Say that again.
When they talk about even the movie Black Panther, they're all big on the aspirational part, what it will do for our kids' future. But then when you ask the question and say, well, I have a problem if you're trying to tell our community that another community center here in Oakland is a good thing for us, and the CIA is our friend. In the
right.
And NGOs are the way to solve the problem. They want to get mad at you when you say that, and I'm saying there's nothing radical about that. It's a fact. You know? How do you feel about that?
Well, that's exactly what I said. I mean, we fully agree. That's why I'm laughing. I'm not laughing at you at all. I fully agree. I'm laughing because that was exactly what I said, and what you predicted as a response was in part a lot of what I've got as a response, a lot of hostility. But I said the same thing. I said, look, if you look at the history, Robert Allen brilliantly already broke this down in that classic Black Awakening in Capitalist America. But the nonprofit movement was a specific response to the Black Power Rebellion. And we're, you know, it's a whole Nixonian thing. So the whole end of the Black Panther film was just so Nixonianly perfect, as the CIA man nods in agreement with T'Challa's speech at the UN. And then they land in a spaceship, and what do? Exactly what Kerner said won't work. You're going to drop an art center. Look, man, Black people are not living in a ghetto and are not poor because we lack inspiration or we lack an art center. It's on some level, it's so frustratingly absurd that I have to laugh when it's maddening. To be constantly told that you suffer only because you haven't seen an image of a Black president. Your child hasn't grown up with an image of a Black president. Man, please. My kids look at Assata Shakur every day. Literally every day they see Assata Shakur and Malcolm X, and our economic material condition has not improved one iota. Okay? So they're perfectly inspired.
Can I ask you one other thing, too?
Go ahead.
Oh, my God, man.
How do we get academics, especially, and I'm not the dumbest person in the world, but when I told you about the thing with the CIA, I was fortunately trained by U.S. government money. I sit underground at a missile silo in the early 70s coming out of the Black Power movement. So I got to see firsthand that what was being told to me at 5 o'clock on the news wasn't the real reality of what's going on in this country. So, and when I try to explain that to people, that's one of the reasons that I understand why NGOs were created and all that. So my point is, even on this Black Panther thing, when it first started coming out and I asked people what went on, I actually watched you and Todd break it down on one of your shows. So the people come back and tell me, well, you didn't see the movie. Yeah, well, look, I understand how Hollywood got started. I understand Hearst. I understand advertisement. And I've worked in a field to understand how media works. I don't need to see the movie to understand that if they tell me the elements of what you just said, that's all I need to know. They're playing the same game on you. I want to know, why are you adverse to facts? What makes you think I have to see the imagery when the script is all laid out the same way? And the other thing is, how are we going to be able to get Black people to understand that if you don't control some resources and get what these two gentlemen talk about, a sustained project that is ready to act instead of react every time something goes wrong?
Thank you for your call, sir.
Thank you.
I love the call. I always say this, and I know how it sounds, but I just don't have any answers when it comes to how do we, when I hear that question of how do we do this and that. And I'm always cautious and skeptical when I hear someone else claim that they do. The answer is always the same. It's vague, and I don't know how to do it. But we have to get organized. It has to happen offline without microphones and cameras. And all of the answers that we will ever need will only come in those spaces. When we do public media work and when we do our public work and I think that should only be for ideas and debate and analysis and perspective. But what do we do and how do we do it should always and only be in organized spaces that are vetted and offline. And I'm only convinced that the answers will come from there. And that's why when I was much more active in those spaces than I am now, I was much more able to identify whatever fraudulent preacher, pimp, academic, journalist, pundit, whatever, would come through. Because if they weren't in any of those spaces that I was in, then I knew that they weren't about that kind of work. So people should look at me in that same way. I expect to be vetted in that same way. And I think that's the only way it can go. So if we don't see, you know, I know you're not going to see the people that you see on MSNBC every day in those spaces. So that's not where the answer is going to come. A lot of the people who do even this kind of work are not in those spaces. You know, so that's not where the answers to that question is going to come. That is the what do we do and how do we do it? But anyway, so I don't know. I really don't know. But that answer can't come in this conversation anyway.
Listen, I do agree. I firmly believe that the answers for these problems is going to come from a think tank. It's going to come from people, conscious people, and not from just one individual. Listen, we're on the same page. Let's go to 267. 267?
Hey, good evening, Elliot, Richard, and Dr. Ball.
How are you, sir?
Peace. All right, fine. Yeah, Dr. Ball, I just wanted some feedback on this because I remember going to college in 1977, and I took up economics 101. I'm talking about basic economics. And in that publication that we were studying from, it said that in order for capitalism to work, there has to be a permanent underclass for capitalism to step on. Now, I remembered that because, you know, because I saw the permanent underclass at age 18. So
right.
And me and Elliot has talked about this before. All these so-called immigrants coming to this country, they're promised some things, like some, you know, some commodities. And I believe that commodity is the so-called permanent underclass for even them to step on. And a lot of stuff that I hear, I believe, and this is just my opinion, is nothing more than putting a smokescreen on that very matter. You know, and Black Panther, I don't even want to talk about that. I'm so, you know, and nothing against the conversation tonight, but it seems like I'm hearing grown folks, 50, 60 years old, talk about going to see this movie 7 times and like that's some kind of accomplishment. I mean, you know, and it saddens me. It really saddens me that I'm hearing so-called adults. Now, I said this on another radio station about how it creeps me out. I'm hearing adults talk about a Marvel comic strip written by Disney and how we think we have arrived and went to heaven over this. And, you know, and I was sort of battered by follow-up callers because they said, oh, he'd rather see something like a pimp and this and that. No, I'm just saying it's a movie. So, you know, so just to get Black Panther out the way, I'm just going there. But could you please give me some feedback on what I've learned at age 18? And I'm not saying just give up because I have not given up. Matter of fact, I went on to do certain things in life. But, and college is a small part of it, but not a major part of it. Because I believe even getting an education, that kind of education is even a smokescreen because I see it putting our people furthermore in financial bondage. So could you please give me some feedback about that?
So first of all, I'm often confused with saying, well, very first of all, I got to start with this. If you got a book in college that said capitalism requires a permanent underclass, then you had a wildly unique experience, and that's amazing. I would be shocked that a book would be that honest and be used in a college classroom. That was fascinating. But I want to also say that, you know, I'm often mistaken as saying, as being, as saying give up, and I am not saying give up. So I agree with you on that. I don't believe in any giving up. What I do, and I would, and I hope I can be forgiven for this sort of paraphrasing of Huey Newton. But what I do advocate is that as Newton said, in terms of a revolutionary suicide, I do think that we need to give up on certain notions that are prevalent in our lives. So I'm not saying, look, we have to survive. People have got to work. People have got to hustle. People have got to do what they've got to do to put, to satisfy the material needs. But what I would like for people to do is give up on certain notions of hope in attachment to symbolism and media, and hope in attachment to popular politicians and things like that as providing real solutions. So while I'm saying we have to give up in popular notions of, individual behavior change as a means to, or as a method of overcoming inequality. Like, I don't, we got to get over the, we got to get past this self-help stuff. We got to get past, I can just shop black and I can just save some money and I can just stop buying rims and I'll be successful. Or we have really got to get past the hustlerism of I can buy, for instance, a Dr. Boyce Watkins economic program and work my way into success and becoming a black millionaire. Like, these are things we need to give up on. Right. But what we do have to do is go back to or get in more involved with, myself included, real organization, real movement building, real again, off the record, building. That's where the solutions will come. We give up on, definitely give up on, who's going to be the next superhero in on a film, or who's going to be the next superhero presidential candidate. Like, these are the things we have to get past and give up on. But definitely not give up just in general, but we do, right, just on some of these myths.
Because, I'm glad you said that, because this is something that always has gotten on my nerves, and it's still the, she was the first black president of this, or he was the first this, or she was the first. We always knew we could get it. We just never was given the opportunity to get it. And then when you do get it, all you're doing is furthermore empowering capitalism. So, and another thing, and Eliot always says this, history, and Dr. Henry Clark, history is very important. Because a lot of things that we need to really pay attention to are already down on paper. Like Booker T. Washington, he said something so important that I wonder why black people never really grabbed the concept of what he was talking about. Booker T. Washington said the best thing for any black person to do is grab a skill and build on it, grab a trade and build on it. And I think he was at odds with the other fella that believed in the talented theft. But, that is so important. If that, right now my son has realized that he needs a skill. I mean, he took him to be 24 years old until he understood this. But now he said, if I have a skill, I can go in business for myself. And that's the whole thing. We need a skill or a trade.
This is the problem. So I love that you brought up Clark and Du Bois and Booker T, because what Dr. Clark used to say was that we needed them all. Like, we can't, right, with this beef between Washington, Du Bois, and Garvey, we this is another thing. We have to get over that. We have to put this to bed. We needed them all, because the problem with yes, we need skills. We need a lot of things. But the problem with what Booker T was saying is that without the Du Boisian political equivalent is also not going to work.
Right.
Because there isn't enough black money to support black business. There isn't enough white investment in black business to support black business. So even if you have a skill, that isn't in and of itself going to mean anything as a guarantee for your individual well-being, and it certainly is not going to be in and of itself enough to help the collective. And again, this is my point. We are not poor because we don't have skills. We are not poor because we didn't learn plumbing. We are not poor because we didn't learn, you know, to fix cars. We're not poor because we didn't learn how to paint. We're poor because the racial and class structures require it. Now, until right. we deal with, and now that's a political problem, and that's why we needed the Du Bois, right? Because without the political movement, then the skills and the trade are useless. Even at the point, raise one just technical point. Even at the point of making of determining the value of the money that is paid for us a particular labor transaction. If you don't have political power, the money you're paid for fixing the plumbing in someone's house may not be worth anything. So this is what I'm saying. Like, this is why I'm saying that when people come on radio or TV or they write something and they say the solution is this, and it's right. something specific, like you need jobs training, or you need financial literacy, or you need a college degree, then they're either lying or they're just not, I would argue, qualified to even be talking about that subject publicly. You know, what is needed is a full spectrum of things that require movement and political power, that go beyond anything about self-help or individual decision making or you know, what we do with our money. Now, I'm not saying this to say, you know, go out and blow your rent money on, you know, a new suit. I'm not saying that. And I'm not saying, you know, go to, you know, buy one fancy restaurant meal a month instead of going to get groceries. I'm not saying being stupid. I'm not saying being irresponsible. What I am saying is poverty is not the result of poor spending habits. And even when you make the correct spending choices, that is not a solution to even your individual problem, and it will not help the collective. So I'm saying do everything we're supposed to do. Let's try everything. And my joke used to be that let's do everything we're supposed to. Let's get all the job training, and let's get all the diplomas, and let's get our hair cut, and let's get our hair right, and let's change our names to John Smith, and we'll get rid of the African names, and we'll get rid of the locks, and we'll get the shaves, and we'll get the suits, and we'll all the dresses, and we'll all be at the bus stop at 5 a.m., and we'll all, you know, we'll all stop smoking, and we'll stop drinking, and we'll pull our pants up, and we'll button up our shirts. We'll put our cleavage and our butts away, and we'll all be at the bus stop at 5 a.m. And by noon of that same day, we will then have the political revolution that I fantasize about on a daily basis, because everybody will then realize that our behavior has nothing to do with our lot and condition in this world. And they will then go to the next stage, and we will be free by lunchtime.
Well, Dr. Ball, with all that being said, I think the first thing we have to admit is this permanent underclass is by design. If we can, with all that being said, then we will have some tools to build on from that. And like a wise old man once told me, because, you know, a lot of our folks like to use the crab in the barrel mentality. He said, you cannot blame those crabs because they're in a desperate situation. Blame the ones that put them in the barrel to begin with.
First of all, that's the point. I'm so tired. Thank you for that, because I'm so tired of that, man, because crabs in a barrel act like crabs in a barrel because they're crabs in a barrel. That's right. The point. So right. Don't tell me to not act like a crab in a barrel when I'm a crab in a barrel.
Exactly.
Don't put me in a prison and tell me not to act like a prisoner. Don't tell me to be victimized and not be a victim. And that's another trick that has been played here. I am not devaluing myself when I tell you that you have victimized me. I am not, quote unquote, becoming a victim. I'm identifying what has actually happened. And this is what Malcolm X meant by, you can't take that knife that's been plunged 9 inches in your back, pull it out 3 inches, and expect to be thanked. That's the point. Don't stab me in the back and then tell me I'm wrong for saying, yo, you stabbed me in the back. Now, we have to identify that you stabbed me in the back. We have to identify why you stabbed me in the back. And then we have to address that you stabbed me in the back. And then we can begin that pathway to recovery or reparations or advance or progress or healing or whatever, you know, people want to call it. But we have been so propagandized into not even putting a name to the situation that we are nowhere near a solution. And that's right. Why I'm in full agreement with all the sentiments that have been shared this evening that have led us to this point that intentional structures cannot just be dealt with by what are ultimately fantasies about what the conditions are and what methods can be taken to address them. And again, well, you know, Kwame Ture used to make it simple. If you want to end poverty, give poor people money. It's just that simple.
Thank you.
If you don't want me to be in debt, for instance, it's real simple. I'll make it real simple and plain. If you don't want me to owe $100,000 in student loan, just erase it. One click, and it's gone. And then I can move on. It doesn't hurt anybody, right? Because I didn't actually borrow $100,000. The entities that have lent it have already.
You already paid back $300,000 and still paying. So, no, I understand what you're saying. This whole thing is structured.
Ultimately, of course, the way things work in the capitalist economy, I mean, they get you both ways, because if they freed me up to not be paying on my student loans, more than likely I'm going to use my money right back into the economy in another way anyway. Right? If what do most of us do? If I don't have to pay that student loan check, I'm going to go what? I'm going to go buy, I don't know,
a Hummer.
Right. I'm going to take a vacation. I'm going to go to the restaurant we never go to. I'm going to go to the movies we never go to. Right? So, I mean, it's all the same, ultimately, at the end of the day. It's just a matter of how do they want people managed and limited and manipulated within the economy. Because ultimately, what is an economy and what is money invented for in the first place? But social control, manipulate people's behavior. That's the whole point. So they can't let poverty go away, because then people might just do some crazy thing like spend more time, instead of rushing to work, thinking about why do we work so much in the first place?
Brother, thank you for your call, man.
All right, I'll take care.
Peace. We're going to take a brief break. Dr. Ball, you got a few more minutes to stay with us?
Sure.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we got some callers on hold. You can get involved, too, in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're in conversation with author, lecturer, and professor of media and Africana studies at Morgan State University, Dr. Jared Ball. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Not a Wu-Tang-a.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
You have the emergence in human society of this thing that's called the state. What is the state? The state is this organized bureaucracy. It is the police department. It is the army, the navy. It is the prison system, the courts, and what have you. This is the state. It is a repressive organization. But the state, and well, you know, you've got to have the police, because if there were no police, look at what you'd be doing to yourselves. You'd be killing each other if there were no police. But the reality is, the police become necessary in human society. Only at that juncture in human society, where it is split between those who have and those who ain't got.
I throw a Molotov cocktail at the precinct. You know how we think. Organize a hood under our chain banners. Red, black, and green instead of gang bandanas. FBI spying on us through the radio antennas. And I'm hitting cameras in the streetlight watching society. With no respect for the people's right to privacy. I take a slug for the cause like Huey P. While all you fake niggas try to copy Master P. I wanna be free to live, able to have what I need to live. Bring the power back to the street where the people live. We sick of working for crumbs and filling up the prisons. Dying over money and relying on religion for help. We do for self like ants in a colony. Organize the wealth into a socialist economy. A way of life based off the common needs. And all my comrades is ready, we just spreading the seed.
Live a third of his life in a jail cell, cause the world is controlled by the white male. And the people don't never get justice, and the women don't never get respected, and the problems don't never get solved, and the jobs don't never pay enough, so the rent always be late. Can you relate?
No more bondage, no more political monsters, no more secret space launches. Government departments started it in the projects, material objects, thousands up in the closets. Could have been invested in the future for my comrades. Battle contacts, primitive weapons out in combat. Many never come back, pretty niggas be running with gas. Rather get shot in their back than fire back. We tired of that. Corporations hiring blacks, denying the facts, exploiting us all over the map. That's why I write the shit I write in my raps. It's documented. I meant it. Every day of the week, I live in it, breathing it. It's more than just fucking believing it. I'm holding in ones, rolling up my sleeves and shit. It's C-Lo for push-ups now. Many headed for one conclusion. Niggas ain't ready for revolution.
Your average black male, live a third of his life in a jail cell. Cause the world is controlled by the white male. And the people don't never get justice. And the women don't never get respected. And the problems don't never get solved. And the jobs don't never pay enough, so the rent always be late. Can you relate? We living in a police state.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. We're joining the conversation this evening with Arthur, Professor of Media and African Studies at Morgan State University. Dr. Jared Ball is with us in conversation this evening. Let's go right back to the phones. Let's go to 216, area code 216. 216.
Yes, Vince calling from Cleveland. How you doing, Brother Elliot?
How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. And Dr. Ball, greetings to you and as well as your co-host.
How you doing?
Good, good. I just wanted to first say that I really appreciated the example that you gave about student loan debt. I was actually thinking about what happened during the mortgage crisis back in 2008 when they gave all that money to the banks. Mm-hmm. And my thought then was if you had given the money to the people who had the mortgages, they would have turned around and given it right back to the banks anyway, but they would have been able to keep their houses. Mm-hmm. So the way it was done was actually backwards. But then when you look at who benefited from it, it made perfect sense for them to do things that way.
Mm-hmm. They also bailed out the banks that were backing the student loans.
Okay,
they bailed out. They got it. Sally Mae and Fannie Lou or whatever. Yeah.
Right. The other
Not
thought
Fannie
that
Lou.
I had.
Yeah, I know. Was it Sally Mae and
Fannie Lou?
Yeah, I know.
Sally Mae and obviously not Fannie Lou, but Sally Mae and the other one. They bailed them out.
Fannie Mae and Sally Mae.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that
yes.
Is.
Right. The other observation that I had, and we keep going back to this this idea about this film that everyone has gotten so energized about. When I did the math after the first 4 weeks, I arrived at the conclusion that black people put $370 million into a pot that benefited Disney and not black people, aside from feeling good about what they saw on the screen for 2 hours. And I'm just wondering how realistic it is for us to have any intelligent conversation and move the needle on the prospect of reparations in this country. I saw something briefly online and I didn't even click on it today. It was on Facebook, but they were talking about the president actually having discussion about reparations, but we know that that is not going to happen. And then I think about how we have all our eggs in the party called the Democrats. And year after year, time after time, they ignore our interests. And we look at the effectiveness of the Black Caucus within that party, and it's doing practically nothing for us. When do we get to a point where we realize that the only way to be effective politically, possibly, is to have our own party and to move things forward that way by being organized as opposed to just sitting on the sidelines and getting our hopes up? We had a black president in office for 8 years, and we're not in any better position than we were before he went into office.
So... Oh, man. So my two cents is this, and I'm really glad that we came back from the break with the Dead Prez track, which I think is not only one of the best albums of all genres ever and most important political albums, but is a perfect segue to this question and point, because I think that, one, I think tactically, first of all, I am a full proponent and supporter of the notion that African descendants in this country, those specifically classified as Black American, or those who experienced the enslavement within this thing called the United States, deserve reparations. All right. I am fully supportive of that. But I think that tactically we need something just bigger than that. One, I don't think there will ever we were talking in the previous hour about the Kerner Commission and the national will. There is never going to be national will in this country sizable enough to support the kind of massive hit that it would require to give reparations to black people in this country. I just think it's a non-starter. We had the longest standing congressional proponent of it was just removed. It, as an elder, as a late stage elder congressman, on sexual harassment or sexual misconduct allegations. And all we got from him was a mention every year that we should get reparations, supported by no movement, no effort in Congress, no move, to borrow the phrase you already used, no movement of the needle anywhere. So I just say it's a non-starter. So what I think should happen is, as Dead Prez said, I'm for a socialist economy. So what I would like to see happen is a movement organized strong enough that is expansive enough to say we need a national reparations movement. Yes, black people deserve reparations, but let's just go ahead and black people as much as any other group. But instead of and I'm just speaking tactically, instead of arguing for who deserves it more, we should just say, look, everybody in this country deserves reparations. This country has a 23 or whatever trillion dollar economy. There's enough money floating around here for every single person in this country, every 350 million of us, to be chilling. And I don't mean just relaxing. I mean chilling, okay? So let's just have a movement where we say, I don't care who's elected and I don't care what party exists. It needs to be structurally institutional. There will be no poverty in this country. There will be no homelessness. There is enough money being generated when we go to the movies. The brother just said, if those numbers are correct, fine. If black people alone generated $370 million, let's offer this movie. If whoever else generated whatever, the point is we generate 23 collectively as a country, we generate 23 or so trillion dollars every year. Why is anybody arguing for anything? Just off the break, let's just take that money and redirect it so that nobody's paying for school, nobody's paying for health care, nobody's paying for a decent house or a home. Everybody is guaranteed some form of employment. And by the way, we should have so much employment matched with so much innovation with technology that people at this point should be working maybe 1 or 2 days a week at the most anyway. And we should all just be chilling and relaxing and enjoying the technological innovation, enjoying the fruit of the imagine the innovation and the imagination and the art that will be created when not so many people are having to work themselves to death on a daily basis. Imagine what ideas will flourish about what we can do as a human race. And I don't mean to just sound fanciful and silly, but I'm saying if we want to be real, I think this is the direction we have to go in, and we have to say, look, there can't be any more discussion of reparations for only one group, because that's never going to be supported. It's never going to happen. And then I think it just turns into a cottage industry hustle where people can get paid some money to present this as an idea to pockets of their community who want to hear it. But the reality, that's not going to happen. And I don't want to have a situation where what? We get a check and then what? We go right back and we buy a couple of things and then what? I don't want any of that. I want a situation where it is going forward impossible for anyone to be poor or starving or to be without a job or without health care or without education. It should be structurally, constitutionally, or whatever it needs to be built in, so that with the money that we generate just gets automatically redistributed so that nobody has to suffer.
Yeah, that just sounds contradictory to what the brother pointed out earlier in the show about the need for a permanent underclass. I just don't think the Europeans would be willing to sacrifice their agenda.
You know, in that case, Brother Vince, then you're talking about what the brother was talking about in that clip I played, the record I played. Well, the MP3 is a revolution. Mm-hmm. You're talking about a revolution, a radical change. Yes.
And I agree with you, and that's sort of my point, though.
Okay.
It's sort of, and I'm trying to lay out a logic here without stating the conclusion. Mm-hmm. I don't think, you know, but that's the point. That first of all, if I think you are right to say, Europeans are not going to come off of that capitalism. They're also not going to come off of any kind of real reparations that we would need to satisfy us going forward. So whatever they would give us would be some hush money that would further complicate the oppression going forward. So I don't want that. I want to push the contradictions to the point to their ultimate conclusion. So I agree. Let's then let that be the next level of the discussion. If you're really saying that the only way out of this is some sort of revolutionary change, then let that be.
You know, it was interesting.
Thank you for your call, Brother Benson.
Yes, sir.
They're raising now this universal income, which seems to me fall to what you were saying earlier when you talk about the Kerner Commission, because they were saying that it's not going to be about programs and universal income, where even I think it's Charles Murray coming out of the American Enterprise Institute is saying, well, give everybody at least 10,000 as a base. You know, whether they're
it's getting complicated. Remember, because Charles Murray is the bell curve cat.
Right.
Who also argued that we should lock up all these black people in colonized ghetto pens because they're inferior.
And that's what makes it, because as what you're saying, in order to try to safeguard the structure itself, the institution of capitalism as it is, but at recognizing that now the nation. And they were just having a discussion when they were talking about the Occupy Wall Street, that, you know, that whole bringing up the scenario of the one percenters, they realize that there is a top. And here in the current, even with the Obama, but in the current 45, that top now is in the system. Those billionaires are in the system, that they're in the governmental system. That they're recognizing, well, okay, we know that at some point those whites are going to have to say, as the young are saying, like, you know, there is no real reform that is going to occur. So we have to restructure it totally.
You hit the nail on the head, and I think we're getting close to having to wrap up. At least I have.
Mm-hmm. I know it. We kept you overtime.
But check this out. This is perfect because you're right. A couple of months ago, and I had to clip this and put a piece on a mix what I like about this and really connected it to the myth of buying power too, because I'm going to the airport at 2 or 3 in the morning to pick up my father-in-law, right? And I'm listening to NPR, and there's this conversation on that blew my mind. And it was with the venture capitalist Nick Hanauer, who was admitting. He said he was sitting there on the radio saying, look, man, I have the kind of money that people don't even know to fantasize about how much money I have. Like, that's how rich I am. Like, you can't even fantasize about my level of rich. But he was saying that he understood, and his line was the people are coming with the pitchforks to the door because they realize that the economy is being stretched, the inequality is being stretched to the point where, as he pointed out, the Starbucks employee cannot even afford to buy a Starbucks coffee. So what that means is that people are going to eventually realize the game is rigged. My work habits have nothing to do with my poverty, and I'm coming for war, and I'm coming to kill you. That's what he was saying. So he was saying, look, I'm obviously, as a venture capitalist, not a fan of socialism, but we have to structure a way of redistributing the wealth we're generating so that we don't get to the point where people are coming to kill me. So as a very way of saving his class, he was saying on public radio to his fellow billionaires, we better make change or they're going to come and kill us.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to give them, I don't mean change to where I give up the fact that I'm super, super rich, but we need to sprinkle out a little bit more. We need to turn the faucet up a little bit more to keep them from, and that's what I'm getting at. So a lot of my work ends up focusing on the media component of that same political will. That is, how much can we sprinkle out in terms of symbolism and hope to keep them from rebelling? So we'll give them a Black Panther, we'll give them a Luke Cage on Netflix, and we'll give them some black people on TV and some pretty people, and they'll smile and everybody will be a little happier. But they're damn sure going to get poorer, and they're damn sure going to keep still getting dragged by the police, and they're damn sure still going to keep getting locked up. So we have to find it now. So then here comes Nick Hanauer saying, in another way, that symbolism isn't enough. Now we actually have to give them a few more pennies Because even with all the presidents and the black people on TV and the superheroes, even the white folks are starting to come for us. And even after a Donald Trump, who was the presidential version of the Black Panther for white folks, mm-hmm. white folks are starting to, are even realizing this is a hustle. And so this is the threat. So that's why I'm saying, like, anyway, that's why I'm saying, like, we need something structural that says, I don't want it, I don't want this to be, I don't want my well-being to be dependent upon a particular political party or a particular set of billionaires who decide to manipulate their political parties to give me a few more crumbs. I want it to be so that my great-great-great-grandchild, if there is still an economy, if there is still something called the United States and my family is locked up in here, I want that great-great-grandchild to be guaranteed benefit from the wealth that is created by his or her country. Because that's what we're all doing. We are all creative people. I mean, we really need to look at it that way. The GDP, the total economy, is like $23 trillion a year. That's what we need to be looking at and say, why are any of us arguing about anything when we're making that kind of money?
Dr. Ball, you got time for one more?
Sure, sure. Let's
get him in. Let's go to 646. 646?
Hey, brother Jerry, you're a bad man. That's all I can say about you. You're a bad man. I would just first like to start by telling you thank you for your hate report at the end of the year. I thought it was an absolute classic. Speak that speak. You know, I got banned on Facebook for saying that. Speak that speak. Hey, brother, when you and your partner did that review, man, I was in stitches for four days on that classic work, man. I tell you, anything you do, I just love it, man. I mean, you're the man. You know what I mean? That's all. You know what I mean? You had to laugh at me the other day when I had to, DM you on Facebook and ask you about the site. But I bookmarked it now, brother. So anytime you do something, I get it. But listen, what I really wanted to ask you about was this. What do you think in regards to the direction that you're going in media wise with this character Roland Martin is trying to pull off? Have you got a understanding and an idea on what he's trying to pull off since News One kicked him off the air?
I honestly don't know. I don't know. All I know about Roland Martin at this point is that especially having seen him at the convocation at Morgan State a couple semesters ago, is that we just have severe political disagreements. But other than that, I don't know what he's doing. So you would have to catch me up on that. I just thought.
All right.
But if I could just say very quickly, and we had a Twitter disagreement because when he came to Morgan, he promoted the same kind of mythology that I think we have to get over. And one of those mm-hmm. myths was that whole thing about working hard and building his connections. And then he promoted, it was just so funny. And I don't mean to, I really don't like that anybody loses their job, even when I don't really agree or like them. But it has to be somewhat funny to see that if anybody caught it, how he promoted, TV One and his work ethic as being what black people need to succeed, and then to see him in a few short months be fired from that same entity for whatever reason. My point being is that when people go around promoting that we are poor or somehow behind because of our own behavior, they're lying or they are not qualified to be speaking in front of anybody, and then he suffered the very same fate. But anyway, I'm sorry, but I don't know what he's doing.
No, brother, you know, anytime you break something down, I love to listen. But I got a follow up right quick on that, and then I'll give you an idea what he's doing. So in the the YouTube Facebook battles of we have so many, whose side do you take, Voice Walking or Yvette Cornell?
Oh,
or neither
Oh, well, that's easy. In that battle, I take Yvette Carnell.
Okay.
Because Boyce Watkins, to me, my opinion of Boyce Watkins could literally not be any lower. When I see someone who claims to be, I think he calls himself a financial specialist, and parade their PhD in front of their people as a sort of a beating stick of some sort of authority, and then charge them, for wildly wrong data and analysis that has itself been exposed to be sponsored by white owned media and propaganda networks. I mean, he is just the height of deplorability.
I
love what Yvette Carnell and Antonio Moore do, but I do disagree with them on some of their positions regarding reparations and regarding black people's relationship to other communities and the diaspora and some other things. But on that issue, I'm clearly with Yvette.
Hey, that's why I say you're a bad man, Jared. You're a bad man. Now, what I was going to say to you in regards to your boy, No Neck, but he's basically trying to pimp the public. I really truly believe to get them to finance some sort of media entity that he will put forward through YouTube, Periscope, Twitter, and Facebook that will be done on a platform on a daily basis. Now, me personally, I don't know if I could really support it because of the Negroes that he has already produced that goes on national media. It just absolutely, as far as I'm concerned, make a fool of us, because you know that Negro Paris Denard, I just like to take my belt off and do my thing on him. You know, every day, any day, all the time. Now, you know, as far as the sister go, Angela Rye, I got real issues with her. But that's you know, here and there. Because I don't need to see no sister going on TV being sad. That don't make no sense to me if you're supposed to be educated and putting forth information. But, that's what he's trying to do.
So, first of all, let me thank you. I appreciate your support, and I definitely encourage others who don't know to check out our annual hate awards
beautiful.
The other stuff at imixwhatilike.org. But I really do think this last one we did was the best one we've done. It was so much
phenomenal.
Fun. I appreciate that. It was
Speak your speech.
Like you got, I mean, you know, but this is why I took the time I took to try to lay out where I am in relationship with this center and the community, because we do have to be honest. And this is part of the critique I had for Roland Martin when he spoke at Morgan State when he did not too long ago. Which is because the reality of the situation is even a Kathy Hughes-owned media outlet is beholden to white advertising dollars to generate the kind of money that they want to generate to pay the kind of salaries that people want to make. So if Roland Martin wants to do some kind of venture on Periscope or YouTube, and he wants to be able to make the kind of money he was making before, and he wants to have the salaries for his partners and this and that and the third, he's going to have white advertising corporate dollars support that show as well. Black audiences don't make enough money, number one, period, don't have enough money to support these media entities at the levels that they want to be supported. So that's why it doesn't matter the gender or the race of the media owner in a commercial environment, because it's the white advertising dollars that determine most of the content. So, you know, speaking of the two other people, Yvette Carnell and Antonio Moore have thousands of viewers on YouTube. I don't know anything about their finances, but I am sure that they're not making the kind of money that they would need to make based on even with those amounts of views on YouTube that you would need to make to sustain a commercially equivalent media outlet. So,
but I tell you what she do right quick, Gary. She has a news. She has a newsletter that puts out. But now to her, that may be the type of money that she's able to function. You know, everybody ain't trying to make that $100,000-$200,000 a year. She may
but
realize
we were talking
that
about Roland Martin, though.
No, but we know that, Gary. Come on now. We don't need to have to go there about knowing that. I'm just putting it in the context that there are some people who are putting forward honest information that if they make $30,000 a year from the people, they'll be happy with it. Now, I can't see no neck being happy just making $30,000 off of the people. So that's why I'm trying to say, you know, that's the direction I think we need to go. Myself, personally, like what you may be trying to do is for us to finance it on a level to where, as even when you were talking about the direction that we're going in as the people, in order to do a third party, we're going to have to be able to finance the third party to be able to punish the candidates, or we'll never get nowhere.
Well, Jay, thanks for your contribution, man.
Have a good night, brothers.
Peace.
You too.
Dr. Ball, listen, I want to thank you for staying overtime with us. It's always good to have you on. The conversation is always provocative, man. And before you leave, give out any information that you want to let the people know. You know, and I'll be in touch with you because I'd like to share some of the I mix what I likes on timeforawakening.com.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I would love the collaboration. I just appreciate the time and the energy and the dialogue. And people can check us out again at imixwhatilike.org and at imixwhatilike for all their relevant social media. And, yeah, man, peace if you're willing to fight for it, man, like Fred Hampton used to say. I appreciate you, and thanks again for having me.
I'll be in touch. Peace.
Yes, indeed. Peace, everybody.
All right.
Peace.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll continue the conversation. You can get involved, too, at 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked?
suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072, spelled new as in numerous, on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
The new age is upon us, and yet the past refuses to rest in its shallow grave. For those who hide behind the false image of the Son of Man shall stand before God, 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 God. Has begun the beginning of the end.
Voice of racism preaching the gospel is devilish. A fake church called the prophet Muhammad a terrorist. Forgetting God is not religion, but a spiritual bond. And Jesus is the most quoted prophet in the Quran. They bombed innocent people trying to murder Saddam. When you gave them those chemical weapons to go to war with Iran. This is the information that they hold back from Peter Jennings. Cause Condoleezza Rice is just a new age Sally Hemings. I break it down with critical language and spiritual anguish. The Judas I hang with. The guilt of betraying Christ, who murdered him, stole his religion, and painted him white. Translated in psychologically tainted philosophy, conservative political right-wing ideology, glued together sloppily, the blasphemy of a nation. Got my back to the wall, cause I'm facing assassination. Guantanamo Bay, federal incarceration. How could this be? The land of the free, home of the brave, indigenous Holocaust, and the home of the slaves. Corporate America, dancing offbeat to the rhythm. You really think this country never sponsored terrorism? Human rights violations, we continue the saga. El Salvador and the Contras and Nicaragua. And on top of that, you still want to take me to prison. Just cause I won't trade humanity for patriotism. It's like MK Ultra controlling your brain. Suggestive thinking, causing your perspective to change. They want to rearrange the whole point of view of the ghetto. The fourth branch of the government wants us to settle. A bandana full of glittering generality, fighting for freedom and fighting terror. But what's reality? Read about the history of the place that we live in, and stop letting corporate news tell lies to your children. Flow like the blood of Abraham through the Jews and the Arabs, broken apart like a woman's heart, abused in the marriage, the brink of holy war, bottled up like a miscarriage. Embedded correspondents don't tell the source of the tension, and they refuse to even mention European intervention or the massacres in Jenin. The innocent screams, U.S. manufactured missiles and M16s, weapon contracts and corrupted American dreams. Media censorship blocking out the video screens. A continent of oil kingdoms bought for a bargain. Democracy is just a word when the people are starving. The average citizen made to be blind to the reason. A desert full of genocide where the bodies are freezing. And the world doesn't believe that you're fighting for freedom. Cause you fucked the Middle East and gave birth to a demon. It's open season with the CIA bugging my crib. Trapped in a ghetto region like a Palestinian kid. Where nobody gives a fuck whether you die or you live. I'm trying to give the truth and I know the price is my life. But when I'm gone, they'll sing a song about immortal technique. Who beheaded the president and the princes and sheiks. You don't give a fuck about us. I can see through your facade like a fallen angel standing in the presence of God. Bitch,
niggas scared of the truth when it looks at you hard. It's like MK Ultra controlling your brain. Suggestive thinking causing your perspective to change. They want to rearrange the whole point of view in the ghetto. The fourth branch of the government want us to settle. A bandana full of glittering generality, fighting for freedom and fighting terror. But what's reality? Martial law is coming soon to the hood to kill you while you hanging your flag out your project window.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and I want to thank our guest that was with us this evening, spent a little time, author, professor of media and African studies at Morgan State University, Dr. Jared Ball, was with us. Interesting discussion. It's always interesting when he comes, Richard, but interesting discussion. Yes.
I appreciate his honesty based off of, you know, this here global capitalist analysis in relationship to where we really stand, whether you call it, you know, surplus or permanent underclass or a race-based where we hold a position within a race-based system within the capitalist matrix, in the sense that you can't look at modification or reform of any kind of being able to actually change anything. And so I really appreciate that from an academic and one who is, you know, engaged in recognizing that they're part of the structure that supports the system. As we say, global white supremacy.
And that's a good point you raise about him being an academic, because the one thing I did appreciate, well, not the one thing, one of the things that he said this evening that I appreciate is that the answers to these situations and problems is going to come from all of us. And right. It's not necessarily going to come from anything publicly. But, you know, what we talk about on the program and on other programs, where we the need to establish think tanks where these things can be discussed, the answer is going to come from people that you might not think will have the answers. That right. young man growing up in the community right now, that young sister that might have two or three children right now that's young, the answers is going to be coming from them. And it's going to come from a form where we can cultivate these answers. The answers is there, Richard. The answers for our problems is here.
And definitely, you know, and I kind of appreciate that, and that the need to have that kind of analysis, you know, I think it's important for us to recognize what he's saying. It also in the sense of we are, you know, media to, you know, I guess what I'm trying to project, Elliot, is I think that when we really look at it from a systemic perspective, media is a tool today, and Western society has moved. It's probably more powerful than whatever bombs and guns that they have in relationship to as a tool, a weapon of control. It has been weaponized.
Oh, certainly, I totally agree with that.
You know the Panther movie is a symbolic representation of how the organization, the Disney organization, has used this tool in order to create a different movement in social control. As he had said, you know, where the Kernighan report was to tell the president and the power elite that modification is not going to change any deal with the question of poverty in relationship to Africans in this country. It has to be more systemic, and it has to be, which is the most powerful thing, our will. Well, media creates a will, you know, and the movie industry, and we see in relationship to the Black Panther, which would be considered a niche movie, has been able to, as a tool, to change the will, because as we heard in some of the callers, where people are having debates and discussion when you're saying it's just a movie. Not that it's just a movie, it has no basis in the reality that we're living right now. So it, but obviously it changed, just like having a black president, it changed the way we're thinking to where we're defending it like it's some, it's giving us something more than we're giving it something. Disney, $500 million locally, and this is a global thing. So those in the UK and who are in Africa who are listening, we recognize that that $1.2 billion didn't just come from us here in the U.S. It came from those in the U.K., those countries in Africa, you know, Nigeria, South Africa, and even those countries in South America who've seen this movie. So this weapon has shaped us. And if we don't see it as a weapon, and we don't see media as a powerful weapon in the hands of white supremacy, then we're missing the mark as far as what we're up against. And I think that that raises, if I'm, my final point, if you don't mind, with the question of Jay, what Jay raised in his question about Roland Martin. Because if media is a weapon, and you use the, all the time about terrestrial radio, when black media, black radio was showing its effectiveness in relationship to galvanizing and organizing black people, the media conglomerates bought them up. And with that, shut down the type of communication outlet.
And wait a minute, put a little something with that. The media conglomerates, along with political help, because they needed that law changed by the Clintons with that Telecommunications Act, was able to buy them all up.
And I'm glad you put that in there, because what did they just push with this net neutrality on one side? Because these podcasts, internet podcasts, is having an effect.
Oh, most definitely. Almost
on
definitely.
The galvanizing and organizing of, the, of black people as a different information outlet.
Yeah.
And here comes Roland Martin, who's going to use this platform. He gets off of one, supposedly, whether he was fired or not, he gets off one platform of news and alphabet. And I'm not even familiar that, you know, the as Jay said, you know, the people that he cultivated on that. He gets off one platform, and now he's supposed to be going to expand in another platform. Those people are going to, and if he is able to do it, so you got net neutrality on one side, and you got, which is saying companies can be able to buy up these air bandwidths that are broadcasting these podcasts where they couldn't do before, and then you have this black media personality who is now going to expand in the space. And he's going to be looking for advertisers. So he's not going to be like a Yvette Cornell or other people who are doing it, like with Time for Awakening, doing it out of the passion and the need to service the people information. He's going to use in the business model. And as Brother Jared Ball was saying, using that model, that means you're looking for advertising. And if you're looking for advertising, now you're on a different platform that they didn't have, and an audience, which now you can reshape. So that's where I see possibly, you know, that direction also is going.
Let's go to
when you talk about Roland Martin.
Let's go to 414.
Good evening, Elliot. Good evening, Brother Richard. How you guys doing? How you brothers doing?
I'm good now. How you doing?
Brother? How you doing?
I'm doing fine, brother. I'm doing fine. I wanted to get in to answer to ask a question or two to Pastor Jared Ball, but it's okay.
Yeah, we didn't. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I know it was busy, brother. I love the dialogue. I've been listening from the beginning, and so I've been appreciating the dialogue. One thing that I really didn't feel or hear is an alternative to this situation that we're in, and that is Pan-Africanism. That is going back home. That is getting together with the brothers and sisters on the continent, along with the brothers and sisters in the diaspora. Dr. Clark said it best, it is our only hope for salvation. Any idea, even the thing that Professor Ball talked about, redistribution of wealth, hell, even Caucasians who are poor don't want redistribution of wealth, because the whole idea of European capitalism is individualism. And so even though they may be poor, but they're an individual, and they feel that they have opportunities, a lottery or striking rich or inheritance or whatever, to be just like that 1%, just like all those other millionaire billionaires. The fact of the matter is this system can never and will never be reformed. There's nothing that we can do. You know, this is an evil system. In fact, what would have been cool is to discuss more about, you know, us lifting up, being a cooperative, pulling resources, being more in a socialist kind of vein to pull resources and everybody share in that, you know. But, of course, in this capitalist system, you know, people want to be millionaires. They want to have money. They want to call the shot, you know. But for us, that will never happen. Let me say this about reparations right quick. I never forget this. There was an article, Charles Kuttheimer. I don't know if you heard of him. He is a Jewish editorialist. I think he used to work for the New York Times, Washington Post, one of the two, whatever. This is about 30-some years ago. He said, we should give blacks reparations. We've already given them affirmative action. We're giving them welfare. You know, let's give them reparations. Because the mindset that they're in at that time, and even today, if let's say we gave them 30,000 a family and 20,000 an individual or whatever, we'll have that money back within the next 3, 4, 5 months. Because they're not going to pool it together to build businesses and make that money work. They're going to buy Cadillacs and Mercedes and clothes and this, that, and the other. In fact, he said we should do it because it will be a big stimulus package. It will stimulate the economy.
Mm-hmm.
And then after we've done that, then they can't say a damn thing about nothing. We gave them this, we gave them that, and so now it's fend for yourself. There'll be no more affirmative action, no more class action. If you've been discriminated against, you probably have been, it's going to be up to you. If you can't find nobody to corroborate, you know, what happened to you, so what? I'm saying is that our situation here collectively as a people is where it is where it's supposed to be, at the bottom rung. We have been determined and designated as a permanent underclass, as a people. I'm not talking about a few individuals who make money, who are athletes and entertainers, you know, and so forth. But I'm talking about the vast majority of our people. And that's what it's going to be until we have the will. As Marcus Garvey says, up you mighty race, you can accomplish what you will. Do we have the will to break the chain that these crackers have on our minds and our bodies? Do we have the will to do that? Because if we don't, that'll be our demise. And so what we need to discuss is an idea and a concept of Pan-Africanism that will work for us as African people, not just here in America, but for African people, period. Malcolm said it again. El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz said, Africans will never be respected as a people until Africa is in control by Africans. Until Africa is in control by Africans. Because another thing, we have no friends. We have no friends in the world, brothers, and y'all know this.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere today on the planet, we get dogged out. We're at the lowest economic rung. We're disrespected and degraded and dehumanized. And yet, we treat people with, I mean, even the Chinese. I read a piece just the other day about how brothers and sisters are being treated in China. But yet, the Chinese are treated with dignity and respect. Well, of course, they come with the idea of doing something for the continent because they want something. They want the resources of the continent because China has no resources. They want the resources. And so they'll build something, but of course they will not use the indigenous people or the people. They won't use their labor. They'll just, you know, make sure they get the resources that they want, and they'll bring in their people. I've seen it happen personally in the Bahamas. I was in the Bahamas for a firefighters conference about 4 years ago, and there's this big, huge resort on the par with what you see in Las Vegas. Huge. And it's being built by the Chinese. But don't no work was going on because the Chinese were on strike. Not the workers, not the laborers, because they were prisoners. The general laborers were Chinese prisoners. We're talking about the management, the architects and so forth. They were on strike, you know, because they don't use any local people in the building of their projects, you know. So, I mean, there has to come a time where Africans on the continent and Africans in the diaspora, and particularly the American Africans, us, because we are the most technologically Africans on the planet. If we got our head up out our butt and not just getting this knowledge and information and any skills to beg crackers for jobs and saying we're getting these skills so we can go and develop Africa, because we cannot do it here. We cannot. I know this weekend there's the Republic of New Africa. They're having their conference in Detroit. And I know some of the brothers. I went to some Republic of New Africa meetings back when they started in the late 60s, you know. And that whole idea of getting five states, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana, and saying this area here, because a majority of our people live here, we're going to take this area and be sovereign. That ain't happening. That will never happen in America. Hell, even Caucasians can't be sovereign here. Hell, didn't they try to do that up in the Northwest, in Washington State or something like that? Although they didn't come down on them hard, but it would us if we try to do something like that. They waited them out. There were a couple of people who did get shot only because they tried to shoot police. But you see, it can't happen. It can't happen here. It won't happen here for us. What happens to us here is by design, and will continue to happen to us until we come to our senses and get out of this madness.
You know, one of the things that it starts on a level that and one of the levels that Professor Ball is working on, the college level where some of our students are, and especially in HBCU where he is, and being a professor in the African American Studies department, these things centered around culture, around identity. Gives our young people pride in themselves and develops a mental state where you build everything around that pride in yourself. That's one of the things that is lacking and that has been lacking, especially since we've been here among Europeans, and that has been lacking on the continent since they've been colonized, is the pride in oneself that has to be restored. In order for us to move forward, that's almost an imperative thing that has to be restored. When you talk about, and I featured that on the timeforawakening.com a while ago, it was several articles coming out of different publications and talked about how Africans were totally disrespected in the continent of China. It through media, whether it's print or television. And it's accepted. And it's accepted because they go to the continent and do business. You wouldn't do that with anybody else on this continent. If you disrespect their people, then they're not doing business with you. But it's allowed because the self-pride is not there, whether you're talking about Africans on the continent or Africans here. This chief rabbi in Israel, last week or 2 weeks ago, we talked about it on Time for Awakening, when he called Africans or blacks
monkeys.
Yeah. And you don't hear nothing stated from these black this so-called black leadership class, misleadership class. You don't hear nothing said about it. They don't demand, but if you hear, they done dragged Farrakhan's name through the mud because in 1984 he said Jews is a gutter religion. So they bring this up constantly. Constantly, they're gonna bring it up. Play clips of the same old thing from 30 years ago. Jesse made some statements about it in Hometown in the 80s. If you disrespect them, you ain't gonna never forget it. But, you know, our people let all these people disrespect them. See, until that thing is, and it might come with a generation of youth and teaching them a manner of respecting themselves and having pride in themselves, then this type of stuff can't go on. You can't have people calling whole people, call a lot of people monkeys. And this idiot president said something similar about 2-3 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got Chinese people totally disrespecting black folks. They had something on there where they did blackface, had Chinese people putting on blackface and acting stupid, similar to what Al Jolson and them used to do here
right.
years ago. And it's accepted because they go right to the continent and do business. I mean, if the continent had any balls, they said, listen, close down that embassy, you get the hell out of here. Any self-respecting country would do that. Until you come back and apologize or whatever you got to do to show that you respect who you're dealing or doing business with. Come on. You know, it starts with us, a reclamation project of us targeting our youth. And
I think what happened, Elliot, is that because of European dominance and enslavement of Africans, and colonization of Africans, the dehumanization of Africans over an extended period of time, also to the manipulation of Europeans for African leadership, establishing these puppets, these neocolonialists, these despots, all of this stuff, all of this madness. And this has been happening globally because to be dark-skinned around the globe is to be despised, is to be shunned, is to be degraded, is to be humanized. That's why bleaching creams is, you know.
Oh, yeah. I understand that. But all I'm saying is that this has to be, and it didn't happen overnight. So
no.
I don't know whether the reclamation is going to happen overnight. When I say overnight, I'm talking about 10 to 15 to 20 years. But it has to happen because we can't romanticize it. We can't say if we go back to the continent, everything will be all right. Because I can take that same mentality right to the continent where I'll have a capitalist mentality, where I want to take advantage of people there. I mean, it's happening now.
Sure, That's why I'm saying that when I talk about a dynamic Pan-Africanism, just as Dr. Clark said, it is technological. It is spiritual. It is cultural. And in that vein, then you don't go to the continent with the same mindset, okay, when you understand that. You're not going to, you know, it's not a capitalistic thing. It's more of a democratic socialism or a system where human life is valued. Culture is valued. It ain't about dollars. It is about making sure that just like in some African societies that you were provided by or provided for, that the least of those had sustenance. They were provided for. No one was left out. I mean, just as Dr. Lawrence said, it's ludicrous that in this country of the poverty and the homelessness and the debt is crazy in this country of trillions of dollars. But when you have the country is not a democracy or republic. It's an oligarchy. The rich run this. That 1% of those billionaires run this. And they don't give a damn even about them poor white folks. They don't care about nothing. In fact, they've already put in place a security force or team that will protect them and their riches. And they may come together, all of them, and do the same, and it would be us as people who have not trying to, you know, influence and get from the have, which, of course, would be detrimental because we would get all blown away because they would have the armament. And, of course, I wouldn't, honestly, Brother Elliot, I wouldn't march, picket, vote, fight, or do a damn thing to stay here in this madness. I would fight the death to help Africa become the nation and the continent that it could and should be with African people running it. What I've seen lately, we had the Us Lifting Us Power Summit here at the same time ASCAC was happening in Philly. That's why I went in Philly. And there's a couple of good presenters. One is the Ledge Group. Are you here for the Ledge Group, the brothers and sisters who are doing work in Africa, growing food and so forth? The Ledge Group, they're doing some work there. Some other couple of good presenters, you know, and it's happening. Also, too, they're talking about a free trade on the continent, the AU, you know, because all the boundaries that are on the continent, are, those boundaries that you see on a political map were drawn by Europeans at the Berlin Conference of 1884-85. So the boundaries are superficial to begin with. But what they're saying is that, you know, what Patrice Lumumba talked about, Kwame Nkrumah, Dr. Cheikh Ja, even Idi Amin Dada, all of them understood that we must have a Federated States of Africa, a United States of Africa. It ain't just Ghana. It ain't just Nigeria, South Africa, Tanzania. No, we must come together collectively and in that way begin to tie Africa together. Build roads, trains, railroads, ports, hospitals, schools, towns, villages, you name it. The work is there. Also, too, that's another thing. Work is there. We can create this to have to, so there'll be work for our people. Because of the automation and the greed of these son of a guns, there's not going to be a lot of work for people. Because machines, they always trying to do what? In a capitalist system, maximize profit. The less I pay you, and you can see in terms of paying people, wages have been stagnant for damn near 20 years. Mm-hmm. Well, and of course you can point that to Ronald Reagan. Reagan was the worst president of this country for
We're going to get ready to start winding things down, brother.
Brother. Well, I appreciate this time. Also, too, I appreciate being on Time for an Awakening, man.
Tell the listening audience when you be on. Although I usually tell them at the end of the program, but being that you're here, let them know.
My program is African Perspectives every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern. And I talk about independence, self-determination, liberation, and sovereignty for African people. To me, there is no other discussion. Everything else is moot. If we ain't talking about that, we ain't talking about a damn thing. In fact, it is ludicrous to even argue with any of us about whether or not we should be free and independent or sovereign. That's crazy. The only discussion we need to have is how do we achieve that? How can we work to make that happen? What are the things that we need to do right now and into the future to make that happen so we can be a people who will once again be players in the world instead of pawns? I appreciate the time, brother. You have a good night, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard.
All right. Peace.
Okay.
You know what? One day, Elliot, I liked it because I agree with Brother Osi about the Pan-Africans, but I'm really concerned on what I'm seeing. I like at one point to kind of develop, and yeah, I guess, you know, we all have our point of view. But
Seeing it in regards to what?
At the Pan-Africanism as it's, I mean, well, specifically, I'm looking at the AU, their move to bring down the borders, because I'm a little skeptical. The question I asked was where Brother OC raised the point that the, you know, when you look at what Sheikh Anna Diop said or what Dr. Clark and others have said, that, and, you know, Walter Rodney and Nkrumah and has said about creating a unified Africa, I'm wondering when I've seen this particular move and this group of African states now talking about that they're going to collapse their borders, they're going to create a, you know, trade agreement, excuse me, between each other, whether they're in the spirit that Brother Osi was speaking of, are they talking about creating a continental Africa or a Pan-African intercontinental unit as those men have the vision that they have projected. Because I'm, you know, as they are doing that now and making that agreement, you know, two of the countries that held, you know, it was 50 out of the 55 countries, 54 signed the agreement. Really, if you would say it, 53, because South Africa didn't necessarily say that they were opposed to it. They just said they wanted to see the end result. But at the same time, you look at all the, we had talked about all the bases of AFCON that are amongst in the in Africa at this point. So while they're talking about this agreement now at the state level, you're looking at the military encroachment by the U.S. and even in the discussion in relationship to the maintaining some level of trade with the European, the ECOWAS, the British part, the British relationship that they have, the English speaking African countries, talking about the still talking about maintaining a trade relationship with the French speaking countries, so it kind of makes it question. We have to do critical analysis in relationship to is this the kind of Pan-Africanism that those men and women were talking about in their vision of a unified continental Africa?
Well, it's not. And, I mean, you can see that it's not, Richard. It's a capitalism that's more based on Eurocentric thought and how they view doing business. You can see it, and plus, you can also see that the populations of those countries that are making moves now, that the people don't seem to go along with that.
Mm-hmm.
It's politicians making those decisions. The U.S. can't go into any country and just start building a base unless a country agrees to it.
Right.
I mean, it's not like, years ago when guys used to go to school and it'd be a bully there taking their money. You know, they take your money as long as you let him take it. You fight back, then they're going to go somewhere else and pick on somebody else. And usually in those countries, if you had a leader that wanted to, quote-unquote, fight back, then the United States would develop, through their CIA, would develop so-called rebel forces that want to take out the current administration. And then the next thing you know, civil war breaks out. That was the method used in a bunch of African countries and still going
Look at Libya.
Yeah, it's still going on now. Mm-hmm. Where you got African countries or leadership that don't necessarily want to go along with what America wants to put down. So they'll conjure up through putting money in people's hands or putting weapons in their hands. They'll develop some type of rebel faction. And next thing you know, civil war breaks out 10, 20 years in a country. Basically devastates it. Devastates their economy and the people. See, we can't, you know, all of this starts in the mind.
And that's where Professor Ball in what he was saying as far a lot of this you're not going to see. And I think that's going to be here. And see in the sense of it may not be visible, because even though those states are doing that, and thinking about that, as you say, on the ground, there is resistance to that.
Look at what happened in Ghana.
We have the vision of, to that, because that's a good example, because I just couldn't, it just was disheartening.
I know, it was just like you said, I was like, I can't believe this.
They will give them a contract to be able to have open access to the country,
unfettered access, and to have a jump off base in Africa, and for $20 million a year, that's the blood money paid.
Mm-hmm.
Now the leadership signed that agreement, or supposedly. Hopefully, we can develop somebody that could come on here and talk about it. I ain't talking about somebody here talking about it from a. Looking in, I'm talking about somebody from the continent or somebody from Ghana that's close to that situation. Come on, Tom, we're waiting to talk about it. I think we can try to get somebody on. Mm-hmm. We got some connections in those areas to talk about that situation. because that's almost like you filling up a bucket of water and the next thing you know somebody done kicked it over.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, some of the clips that we've been playing where they wanted Africans from the continent to come back home, you know, to repatriate there, and then you do something like this. I mean, that's the demon that you want to try to get away from, and you don't open the door so you have unfettered access. That's the problem, man. It ain't about our people necessarily wanting to repatriate or developing a love for the continent. You can't take that mindset back there. You just can't. It's not going to work.
Too many of our
people are addicted to white, just like Dr. Fox is saying.
And that's why I think that we need to, on the ground, that resistance, that's, you know, that true change, the change agents, and, you know, whether we call it revolution or not, you know, we have to build economy around that, a political economic economy around us getting reparations by repairing ourselves and then repairing our mindset. And I think that we're working through this. You know, Brother O.C. mentioned about us lifting us, that cooperative, that's a systemic structure that's being organized, reorganized, because cooperatives has been an actual part of the American African experience since we've been here and has been disrupted by the capitalist incursions. So, you know, to break up, when we talk about the Republic of New Africa, and I always raise that about the cooperative land grant, you know, and working with those southern five states, that was intentionally broken up by those large agribusinesses. To you know, you had talked about, you and Reggie used to talk about the whole thing of the black farmers, and we see how they're being disrespected in relations. So that system, you know, when they're lifting us, is actually putting that system in place, is re-energizing something that we know work. But we also know from history is some other elements have to be put in place to make that happen. But we have to be able to put an economy around where we can be able to create a livelihood around repairing our mind. If we, you know, we can't just say our mind have to be repaired. We can't just say, we have to deal with our history. We can't just say we have to, you know, project our culture. We have to be able to produce something.
Exactly.
Where people make a living doing it. And that's why I would suggest, and that's not just here, that's in the Caribbean, that's in the South America, the subcontinent South America, that's in Africa, because as it was said, our mind has been disrupted. African mind has been disrupted continuously for 500 years. And we have just even come to the consensus by some of the research and those members of the think tank, Bobby Wright, you know, Amos Wilson, that's here. They ain't saying what's been happening in Mexico and Brazil, those academics, those think tanks there, or in Ghana, or in the Cameroon, or whatever. We're working everywhere to say, recognize that our mind has been disrupted, and we have to get our mind back. But we look at these leaders, Miss Leadership Class here, Miss Leadership Class in the Caribbean, Miss Leadership Class in South America and Brazil. They just killed organizers in Brazil, and they had a large turnout of people because she was speaking about the social justice, the misleadership class on the continent. You know, we can't look at them and the policies that they put in place as going to be the redeeming or laying out the vision. And that's where Professor Ball's, you know, point about the media, if we say it's a tool, we can't buy into what they project to try to even give us a feel good, call it, you know, Black Panther. But on the ground, we are doing things, you know, to project, to deal with a race in our mind, but we also have to be able to provide a livelihood. So when we do cooperatives, it has to be able to deal with our mind, provide a livelihood, and reflect our historical culture.
It's just imperative. And doing that is reparation, because reparation basic is about repair. It's about self-repair first. It's not about going to the government. Especially a government we know historically ain't going to pay us for what it took from us. And that's 500 years of free labor and a whole continent of natural resources.
And, you know, looking at the situation that we face here, it's multifaceted. It's different ways to approach how we're dealing with it, and it's different ways that we're going to have to approach how we're dealing with it, because we're here. We're not anywhere else right now. We're here. And we got to make it where we can at least survive while we're here for however long this place is even here. I'm talking about this United States exists. We got to make it so our people can survive while we're here. So when you talk about this situation that happened out there in Sacramento, mm-hmm. I mean, it's happening all over. It can probably happen tomorrow. You pick up the newspaper or look on the television, and it didn't happen again. We got to put a stop to this while we're here. We can't, you know, hope maybe 10, 15 years from now that we'll be in another place and miraculously have a change of attitude. This stuff has to stop now. We got to devise ways to stop it now. It's just like, Richard, I'll use an example. Just say I'm renting a house or renting a dwelling. I don't like where I'm staying at. I don't like the place. So I'm not going to move, or anybody with any common sense is not going to move until you prepared another place, especially if you got a family. You got to prepare another place. Whether you move into a house that's already built or building a home from scratch. You don't just move your family out there in the wilderness and just rough it until you build a place. You stay where you are until you have a place prepared. I mean, that's how I would look at it.
Yeah.
So if you got to stay where you are, even though you might not like where you are, you got to make it comfortable where you are. And when I say comfortable, I'm not talking about comfortable for everybody. Comfortable for your family. If it's rodents in the place, then you got to put down some pesticide and keep the rodents down until you can get out of there. If you got a leak in the place, you don't just let water or sewage run all over the place. You stop the leak until you can get out of there. Because in your mind, you don't plan to live there. You plan to get out of there. Mm-hmm. And while you have put down the poison or fixed the leak, all of your resources and your mindset is building your new place so you can get out of there. That's what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. So this stuff that's going on here, we have to put a stop to it. Come up with ways to put a stop to it. I want to play this clip. I don't know whether you saw it, Richard. It was on NPR. They interviewed a young activist out there in Sacramento about what happened out there in regards to the young man getting shot in his grandmother's backyard, Stephen Clark. Let me play this for the listening audience. I mean, we're familiar with basically. Wait a minute, I lost track of where I put it at. We're kind of familiar with the scenario of what's going on, but I want the listening audience to hear something that he has to say, because I want to. And you might put your finger on it right away, Richard, but I want the listening audience to hear it because I think it's a problem. Let's hear this clip.
Okay, we'll go now to Sacramento, California, to continue our conversation with Barry Axias, founder of Voice of the Youth in Sacramento. Barry, in part one of this conversation, we talked about what you understood happened on that day. But describe the neighborhood. Why, at this point, as the family reconstructs what happened, where Stefan was, and how these police officers came to kill him in a hail of 20 bullets.
Well, the unfortunate thing about this community, though it's resilient and rich in spirit, there's no opportunity there. There's nothing. There's nothing that you can grab. I mean, you have a liquor store. You have a bunch of churches. You have about 20 churches on one street, and you don't have one thing that's culturally relevant as far as the majority of that community, black residents. There is nothing that resonates except a major community center, which is decent. But across the freeway, you have a place called Delta Shore that's striving, that shows opportunity. So in that moment, when you're looking at this place and how dark it was, the bad lighting in this community, the fact that individuals, the police officers who know that they're coming into a neighborhood that's overly policed and a neighborhood that has some kind of different criminal activity, it was like they just was headhunting. And the fact that this young man was gunned down, and we still don't really know if he was this alleged suspect, we still don't really know what he allegedly did to be assassinated. It's just mind-boggling that this new police regime that a lot of us push for, the policies that we have kind of influence for the city council to embark on this police so things like this wouldn't happen, it wasn't used. My thing is, why wasn't non-lethal weapons used at this point? Why didn't you guys clearly say that we were the police? There was no clear recognition for Stephon to recognize that this was the police. It was hands up, gun. In a few seconds, I can't understand that. Right now, I'm going to show you something. I have a cell phone. I'm going to point this cell phone right at you. Does this look like a gun? And if you can answer that question logically, you tell me what the police saw really and what they didn't see. So it just comes for so many rooms of error. But again, the fact that they used excessive force when it was unnecessary, the fact that they didn't call backup, the fact that they didn't have the helicopter shine that bright light that a lot of us young black males who have ran from the police know, and the fact that they lied and made it seem like this young man was attacking them, it all just continues to paint this picture that's happened across the nation, how police conduct themselves when dealing with black males or black females in America.
Barry, compare this to, for example, Nicholas Cruz, the mass shooter in Florida. Compare this to Dylan Storm Roof when he was caught, who gunned down the parishioners at the Mother Emanuel Church and how he was dealt with.
If that's a serious question, white privilege matters. See, here in America, black people have to compromise way too much. We have to compromise for the fact that if we had Skittles in our hand in Arizona, if we have a cell phone, if we're playing our music too loud, if we're having a toy gun in our hand, if we're walking around with a hoodie, we have to compromise. It's always the issue of, well, you should have did. Well, Stephon Clark shouldn't have ran. Stephon Clark was not running. He was walking to his grandparents' house. If he was running from the police, why would he stop at his grandparents' house to try to get inside? So understand that with black people living in America, all we have to do and all we've been doing is compromising. And every time we ask for justice, it's almost dead cries on dead ears. And when you look at these cases, you had a white male who killed 17 people. He walks out unblemished, in jail, and his privilege shows where now you have a national movement talking about gun violence. Well, here in Sacramento, we've been arguing, yelling from the sky about gun violence here. And until Stephon Clark died, now Sacramento and the world is listening to the cries of the people.
Richard. I'm sorry, Richard.
Yeah, you talking about all those churches on the block?
Yeah. You caught that. You caught that. You know, I want to play it again for the listening audience to get. Now, this is a young. This was a young brother. He represents the organization of young people there in Sacramento. If I can find it again, I just want to play it again in case it was missed by the listening audience. Let me grab that again.
California, to continue our conversation with Barry Axios, founder of Voice of the Youth in Sacramento. Barry, in part one of this conversation, we talked about what you understood happened on that day. But describe the neighborhood. Why, at this point, as the family reconstructs what happened, where Stefan was, and how these police officers came to kill him in a hail of 20 bullets.
Well, the unfortunate thing about this community, though it's resilient and rich in spirit, there's no opportunity there. There's nothing. There's nothing that you can grab. I mean, you have a liquor store. You have a bunch of churches. You have about 20 churches on one street, and you don't have one thing that's culturally relevant as far as the majority of that community, black residents.
You hear him, Richard?
Yeah.
Nothing culturally relevant. You got 20 churches on one block, he said. Mm-hmm. Nothing culturally relevant. That's an indictment, Richard, on not our spirituality as black people, but what we choose to believe in. Mm-hmm. That's an indictment. It's not culturally relevant. Now, I would assume that the churches he's talking about are Christian churches or some mm-hmm. derivative of a Christian church. Not culturally relevant. Now, all you got to do is take that same Bible that was screamed about this Sunday in churches on Resurrection Day. Take that same Bible and that Yeshua that a lot of the pastors, what does Jay say, pork chop chicken eating preachers mm-hmm. were screaming about. Mm-hmm. If you look at what he's saying, he was screaming about the Europeans, Romans at that time, who had annexed that area that they lived in. They came from a foreign culture. They were barbarians as far as those people was concerned. But they had incurred on those people's lives and on the life of Yeshua, which was the people popularly called Jesus. They didn't want to go along with that. He didn't want to go along with that. So you see here that, and plus it was clear that those people that you read about didn't look like those Europeans that came out of Greek and Rome and Greece. They didn't. If you look at that story, according to the text, when they was looking for the child that was supposed to have been born, his parents took him to Egypt. Now, during that period of time, and that period of history you're talking about, you ain't going to know happen. There's no white man that can hide in Egypt. Hmm. And he stayed there until he was in his 20s or something when he came back, 30 years old or whatever it said when he came back. One of the other apostles according to the text, that was with him, the one that was called Paul. I don't believe any of those guys' names was any European names. But when he was doing what he was doing in those cities, and he was accosted by centurions or arrested. When they went back before the governor, Pontius Pilate, they said, this Egyptian has turned the city upside down. Mm. Now, you didn't have no Greeks and Romans back then referring to no other white person as no Egyptian. So don't stop teaching that European Christianity bullcrap in these churches. You can make it culturally irrelevant. You can start teaching those people that the people that they were supposedly reading about look like them. Instead of teaching, oh, it don't matter what color you look like, God loves everybody. Well, then how come we getting our foot put up our ass all the time? It's something that we're not doing. It's something wrong. This young man said that there's nothing culturally relevant going on in his community beside liquor stores and about 20 churches. I didn't say it. He said it. So then what are we planning to do about that? Because he's not alone, Richard. You know he's not alone in that sentiment. I can go out here in Philadelphia and hear that same sentiment among young people. Mm. I mean, am I wrong? I mean, you tell me.
No, no.
I don't want to seem like I'm on a soapbox or rant.
No.
But I wanted to play that for the listening audience, to hear what a young person had to say about his neighborhood. It's nothing there, nothing culturally relevant. Liquor store and 20 churches. He said 20. I would hope that he's exaggerating, because he said, Richard, he said it's 20 on one block. Did you hear what he said? I'm hoping he's exaggerating. I think he would be, but in his exaggeration, he's making a point. And for him to characterize those places as not being culturally relevant, then there's something wrong there. There's something wrong with the teaching going on in those places. And I'm not trying to bash anybody's religion or what somebody choose to believe in. I'm just dealing with the fact of the matter. The fact of the matter is that young people that look like me and you said that stuff that we've been teaching and believing in, or that people have been teaching and believing in, that was taught to us, is not culturally relevant.
Mm. There you go.
You know, and before we leave, too, because we was talking about this with Professor Ball. In that Kerner Commission report, Richard, when Professor Ball was saying that was the most honest report that was written by Europeans about the situation, in that Kerner Commission report, and I kind of highlighted that segment there that he commented on, when it said that the Kerner Commission report pointed to Black America's frustration and feelings of powerlessness regarding extremely high rates of unemployment and underemployment, poverty, police brutality, and inadequate public services. The report continued that a large or poor population was confined to central cities where a predominantly white population moved out, and that the racism of white America was essentially responsible for the explosive mixture leading to uprisings. So they know what's causing all of this.
Mm-hmm.
So what did they do in regards to that report? Nothing. Now, that guy, Daniel Moynihan, was an advisor to four presidents. It mentioned three, if you look at the bio on him. But it was four because he was involved with Kennedy and then Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he was a Democrat because I think he ran for senator in New York.
Right.
Or won for senator. He was a Democrat. Right. But, see, that's what I'm talking about. It's black people that get caught up in all this Democrat-Republican BS. Because he was a Democrat that worked with Johnson, but then he went on to work with Nixon and Ford. He was the head of housing and urban development, I think. He's the one that came...
He's the ambassador to UN.
Yeah, he's the one that came up with that policy of benign neglect. This was after he was involved in an administration that wrote up this Kerner Commission report that they seen exactly what's causing all these problems. So he came up with the policy of benign neglect. I mean, just ignore them. And then they came up with other policies to marginalize black people and get them out of these cities, which some of his policies now, Richard, is being implemented now. These gentrification things, that was basically a proposal by Moynihan years ago. So these people know the problem, and unless we do something about it, it's like you're on a treadmill with your feet moving fast and you ain't going nowhere. All they do is just raise the bar or put the glass ceiling. You hear some of these apologists for this system or integrationists talking about, our people have made progress. And we got jobs. We got this, that. And if you notice, it's nothing has changed.
Mm-hmm.
The percentage of homes that black people own is the same as it was 50 years ago. In fact, in some cases, it's lower. The money that you've earned, sure, now you've earned a little more money than you did in 1965 or 68. But relative to the economy, it hasn't changed. Your net worth has definitely changed for the worse. So any of these policies that was talked about during that report, they had no intention on changing them. The premise of that report is we're moving towards two nations, black, one white, separate and unequal. It isn't moving towards that whole thing. Like I said before, when he was on, it was bull crap. No moving towards. This country was established like that. That's how it was established. So they just haven't changed, and which they don't intend to change. That's not in white folks' DNA. And if they change, it's just a facade. It seemed like they're changing, but it's another policy in the back where, you know, you're going to get the foot put up your behind because you don't realize it. And we see that more and more all the time. So it still goes back to what we've been stating all along. We got to come up with ways where we're going to deal with this. One way or the other.
That's it.
Yeah, well, listen, it came up on the end of another program, and it, like I said before, it was an interesting discussion with Professor Ball. I'm looking forward to putting some of the I Mix What I Likes on timeforawakening.com. Yeah. And I like that conversations in the car, Richard. That you got me kind of hooked on. I like those. I like that.
Yeah, it's I think, you know, they're honest about that. But I didn't get to hear the piece that Jay, I got to go back and find that end of the year piece.
See, more and more, Richard, you got to start doing that. You got to put your face on the camera so people can see it.
Oh, no. Don't even go down.
And you can't do the conversations in the car because you don't drive. So I don't know how you go. Maybe the conversation's on the bus. conversations on the bus. That's a good idea, right?
Don't even try. Even though eventually somebody will. Yeah.
I don't know how that's going to work out,
though. Yeah, yeah. Oh, man. Totally in the public.
Listen, we're going to start out this week with, I'm sorry, Brother Oshie, who you heard on a little while ago, African Perspectives with Brother Oshie, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, African Perspectives, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. It's a full schedule on Time for Awakening on Mondays because at 6 in the evening you have Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed. That's on from 6 to 8. And from 8 to 9, Let's Buy Black365.com Connect is on from 6 to 8, from 8 to 9 on Time for an Awakening. Tuesdays, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers is on Tuesday evening at 8 o'clock from 8 to 10. On Wednesday, well, I would say Revive, but Sister POC is in, she's in Uganda, I think. And she'll be there for about a
Uganda.
Month. I think it was Uganda. You know what? I hadn't talked to her. And she told me she was leaving this week. Because I keep saying she's in Uganda or Nigeria. But when I talked to her, I forgot where she said she was going to be. So, you know, I want to play some of her pre-recorded shows in her time slot. So I just want to find out exactly where she's going to be so I can kind of make a little promo in reference to it so people don't call up and things like that. But she's going to be away. But you'll hear something in regards to her program on Wednesday. Her regular time slot, probably from 8 to 10. On Thursday, Us Lifting Us, a black economic movement, is on Thursday evenings from 9 to 10. Then on Fridays, Time for Awakening is back on Friday evenings at 8 o'clock. On Saturday, SST. Saturday Sports Talk with Brother Troy Wilmore is on Saturday mornings from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. And that's the lineup. Brother Richard, there's a few things going on that I want to bounce off you first before I let the listening audience know about some new programming coming on. But Time for Awakening is moving on. And I just want to thank all of the hosts that add to Time for Awakening because they all add a unique perspective. They all add content that is necessary for our people to redeem and reclaim our minds. It's all a part of what we need to do, Richard. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware. Oh, I know the things that they'll soon have to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. Soon it will be their turn to try and save the world. Right now they seem to play such a small part of. And little Mary, she said she got to teach school. If we know, all we say we know about the problem.
To save the children.